Good morning. The house will come to order. Our flag salute this morning will be led by Representative Barton. I'm sorry, our flag salute this morning will be led by Representative Wingard.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our opening ceremonies this early morning will be presented by the Reverend Jim McMurray, who is the senior pastor, the new senior pastor at Hoodview Seventh-day Adventist Church in Boring, guest of Representative Barton.
Let's pray. Dear Lord, remind us today of who we are and who you are. We pray in the name of our Creator God. Amen.
Thank you, Reverend McMurray. Representative Barton, courtesies.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please join me in welcoming Pastor Jim McMurray, who is the pastor at the Seventh-day Adventist Church out in Boring. He's been there since August. He was previously a pastor at his previous church for 17 years, but his wife is actually from Boring, and he and his family have returned and actually bought the property on which his wife grew up. He's doing a wonderful job out there. And also, thank you for a very good prayer. Mr. Speaker, if I may, I'd also like to read this moment's, our Oregon History Moment, if I please. Colleagues, today's History Minute is adapted from an entry in the Oregon Encyclopedia by William Robbins, who is a distinguished professor emeritus of history at Oregon State University. It's about the Vortex One. During the war-hot summer of 1970, thousands of young people began streaming towards Clackamas County's Milo MacGyver State Park to attend Vortex One, a state-sponsored rock music festival. Ed Worcesterhall, chief of staff to Governor Tom McCall, had selected the 847-acre site some 30 miles southeast of Portland, just outside of Estacada. The park provided all the advantages that he sought: a rural setting, proximity to Portland, and easy driving distance from I-5. The festival was strategically planned to attract young anti-Vietnam War protesters who otherwise might descend in Portland to disrupt the American Legion's annual convention, including an appearance by President Richard Nixon, which would begin on Sunday, August 30th. Even before Vortex One began, 2,000 people had entered the park. By the time the festival officially opened on Friday, August 28th, the population of MacGyver State Park had reached 5,000. At the close of the concert second day, some 35,000 young people were jostling for space in the hot afternoon sun. Vortex One was a rousing success. When the thousands of rock festival fans began to leave MacGyver State Park in droves on Sunday, most of them simply returned to their homes. In the end, President Nixon canceled his Portland visit, and only two small marches took place in the city. And actually, colleagues, when I canvass around that area, people do still talk about Vortex One.
Further courtesies, Representative Greg Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I have two honorary pages here at the Capitol this morning. Now, I'm going to ask them to stand. The first one is Sean Overbay. Sean, stand up. And why don't you have your sister stand up as well, Jessica. Colleagues, Sean and Jessica reside in North Powder, which is right there on the Union County border by Baker County. They attend North Baker Middle School. And Jessica's activities include basketball, young hunter education, and archery. It's good having you here, Jessica. And Sean is very actively involved in FFA and Young Ambassadors, and his career ambition is a very simple one. He simply wants to be President of the United States of America. Welcome to the Capitol.
Further courtesies, Representative David Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to recognize an honorary page from my district, Kayla Foster. Stand up. Kayla is an eighth grader at the Oregon Connections Academy. She enjoys basketball, reading, and is a member of the Franciscan Girls Club. Her career goal is to be a librarian. Colleagues, I urge you to extend the courtesies of the House to Kayla.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have two honorary pages, both from the Fernwood campus of Beverly Cleary Middle School, or K-8 school. First, Portia Cedar. Portia, would you stand? Thank you. Portia is 13. She's in the eighth grade, and she is a volunteer at the Oregon Humane Society. She does soccer, plays piano, and loves reading. And her career goals are architecture and design. Welcome, Portia. And then second, Lucy Brockman. Lucy. Lucy is also 13 and an eighth grader, and she's a young woman after my heart. She loves writing and literature, and she would like to go into the Peace Corps and then become a lawyer. Welcome to the House, both of you.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have the honor of welcoming one of our honorary pages, Lena Childress, if you would stand. An eighth grader at Beverly Cleary Fernwood. Thanks for being here.
And Representative Kenmore, I believe your three pages have just arrived, right on time. So if you're ready to go, Representative Kenmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and nice to have my pages arriving. One of them is Peter Hilbert. Peter, you want to stand? Welcome to the House of Representatives. Peter is homeschooled, and his interests are soccer, martial arts, and drums. Nice to have you with us. We'll look forward to getting acquainted. Second is Betsy Schollenberg. Nice to have you with us. Also homeschooled, 12th grade. And her interests are basketball, soccer, violin, and guitar. Became bilingual, Spanish, Espanol, bueno, and works with children. That's where she wants to go. And then finally, our third one is David Schollenberg. David, you're a ninth grader, and electric guitar, computer graphics are his interest, and hopes to be a computer engineer. Welcome all three of you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
And Representative Dembrough, you have one more courtesy?
I do, Mr. Speaker. I'm sorry, colleagues. Celeste Chow somehow got put into other papers. Celeste Chow is 14, in the eighth grade, also at the Fernwood campus of Beverly Cleary School. And she has many interests. She's in student leadership. She's on the environment committee, does kung fu and rock climbing. She would like to be a marine biologist working in conservation. Celeste, well worth waiting for. Please extend courtesies to her colleagues. Thank you.
Any further courtesies? We welcome all of our pages here today. Thanks for your service to the House today. We appreciate you being here. And we also would note that yesterday was Representative Scott Bruin's birthday. Happy birthday. Hope you had a good day. Clerk, we'll now open the voting system to verify the presence of a quorum. Representative Greenlick. Representative Greenlick is off the floor. Excused for business to the House, Representative Olson. Excused, Representative Buckley, Representative Shields, Representative Freeman, and Representative Thatcher. A quorum is present. Messages from the Governor. Messages from the Senate. First reading memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Propositions and motions. First reading of House bills. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 2068 relating to transfer of tax credits. House Bill 2155 relating to removal of fill permitting program. House Bill 2156 relating to mitigation for water resources. House Bill 2290 relating to crime. House Bill 2370 relating to motor vehicle insurance policies. House Bill 2403 relating to forfeiture. House Bill 2699 relating to the application of prevailing wage rates and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2705 relating to vocational assistance for injured workers. House Bill 2745 relating to development review processing. House Bill 2784 relating to Oregon financial institutions that receive funds from the Troubled Asset Relief Program and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2802 relating to non-economic damages and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 2907 relating to interstate agreements concerning prevailing rates of wage and declaring an emergency. House Bill 2940 relating to renewable portfolio standards. House Bill 2952 relating to small-scale local energy projects. House Bill 2953 relating to bidding requirements for public improvement contracts. House Bill 2955 relating to retainage in connection with public improvement contracts. House Bill 2962 relating to residential housing. House Bill 2999 relating to the best society use reporting system and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3004 relating to sales of foreclosed property and declaring an emergency. House Bill 3082 relating to tax compliance and prescribing an effective date. House Bill 3117 relating to post-secondary education program. House Bill 3121 relating to keep kids safe registration place. House Bill 3122 relating to malt beverages. House Bill 3201 relating to Oregon Liquor Control Commission licenses. House Bill 3271 relating to crime. House Bill 3417 relating to estray animals.
Bill's read for the second time. We're past the third reading calendar. Consent calendar. Third reading of House bills. The chair requests unanimous consent that House Bill 2727A be moved to the bottom of today's third reading calendar. 2727 to the bottom of today's third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3021 relating to emergencies.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3021A. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Sorry, you got ahead of me. Colleagues, House Bill 3021 comes to you from the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. It was developed after 4 months of work by the Oregon Law Commission's Work Group on Emergency Preparedness. Now, I'm sure that none of you would deny that Oregon needs volunteers to help in disaster relief efforts, as we simply can't afford to keep on staff hundreds of employees in case of an emergency. Fear of tort liability is one of the big stumbling blocks for getting people to volunteer. The Oregon Tort Claims Act provides tort liability protection for employees, officers, and agents of the state. If they are sued for committing a tort, the government will indemnify them, and all claims will be against the public body, not the individual or volunteer. That's current law. The problem is that volunteers must fit under the agent category to be covered, and that is not clear in existing law. So it is this question that resulted in the Oregon Law Commission being asked to review existing law for any lack of clarity. This bill now makes it clear up front what volunteers must do in order to be covered by the Oregon Tort Claims Act during a declared emergency. That is, it says what volunteers must do to be deemed agents. It might be helpful to explain that the Oregon Law Commission exists to provide clarification and improvement in Oregon law. To accomplish this purpose, the Commission relies on knowledgeable work groups to pursue its various substantive law reform projects. Individuals appointed to serve on a work group are expected to exercise independent judgment when working on law commission projects by speaking and voting on the basis of their individual and professional convictions and experiences. They take that directive very seriously. I had the pleasure of serving on the task force whose efforts resulted in House Bill 3021. It was co-chaired by former Representative Greg McPherson and Greg Moe, and included representatives of the Department of Human Resources, Oregon Emergency Management, the Association of Counties, Search and Rescue, and a whole lot of lawyers. I found the task force to be challenging, to say the least, and ORS 401 was thoroughly examined. But I'm proud of the result. The bill provides for coverage under Oregon Tort Claims Act and workers' compensation for qualified emergency responders as long as they are performing service under the direction of a public body during a state of emergency. It clearly designates qualified emergency service volunteers and clarifies their services as agents of a public body. Special attention was also given to search and rescue volunteers working under the direction of a county sheriff or designee. The bill provides counties the option to provide either workers' compensation coverage or medical insurance to an injured qualified search and rescue volunteer. This option was granted at the request of counties because a number already provide such medical coverage, but the issue did result in the one area of disagreement both on the work group and in committee discussion. Finally, the bill clarifies definitions and significantly reorganizes ORS Chapter 401 to improve clarity and make it readable for our state, managers, and citizens. This area of law has not been comprehensively updated since the Cold War. This update is timely and necessary. I urge your support of House Bill 3021A.
Further discussion, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I happen to serve on the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee, and I'm proudly there with my colleagues and appreciate the hard work. But I want to just caution the body that actually what we're doing here with this bill, by the amendment, is we're giving the choice to the counties on providing either workers' comp or health insurance. This is a pretty big deal. And it's a big deal because really what we're providing to our search and rescue volunteers is a very false sense of security. Now, during committee, I voted no on the amendment with the right, and I voted to move this to the floor with the right to change my vote. I want to tell you that here's kind of the gist of my concerns. This committee, consisting of 20 folks in the task force, produced a 14-page document. Clearly in the document, it indicates that it's be workers' compensation. It doesn't give the option of either or. When the Association of Counties brought forward, I'm assuming they were the ones who brought forward the amendment, I had some questions, and when they came to my office, I asked specifically, and this is after the bill was coming to the floor. They never got back on this question, and here's the question I asked. Specifically, if a Multnomah County volunteer of search and rescue is deployed by the sheriff to a different jurisdiction, for an example, as the example given, Josephine County, what will the leverage of coverage be? What will the level of coverage be if they're injured on that deployment? They couldn't tell me. The problem is the false sense of security comes when we have search and rescue volunteers performing very dangerous tasks on their own time, thinking they get one coverage, in a sense they get another. Health insurance varies, as you all know. Deductibles change. Coverage can change. Workers' comp is a completely different animal where it covers your wage loss and several other things to those employees, not employees, but I'm sorry, but those folks, search and rescue. Now, specifically in the report, it says, the proposal provides a clear mechanism for government compensation of qualified volunteer emergency providers injured in both governor-declared emergencies and in search and rescue operations by providing them coverage under workers' compensation. Enacting these provisions will alleviate concerns expressed by volunteer providers about who will bear the responsibility for compensating them or others injured while these volunteers are providing essential services for the benefit of Oregonians during emergency situations. While the work group recognized the financial cost to government, it found that government responsibility for compensation under these circumstances is fair and just. Again, it's 14 pages, but a couple of key points. Qualified search and rescue and emergency service volunteers provide extraordinary and necessary service to Oregon and its citizens during times of crisis. They're to be commended for their willingness to serve. The work group's proposal assures that if these volunteers are injured in the course of providing services, they will be compensated for their injuries through a public body providing them with workers' compensation coverage. Such coverage makes workers' compensation the exclusive remedy, thereby precluding any tort claim by the injured volunteer against the public. Lastly, it closes with, while there may be a fiscal impact associated with the part of the proposal requiring workers' compensation benefit to emergency service workers and search and rescue volunteers, the policy choices contained within this proposal are the right ones considering the essential service these volunteers provide to Oregon. Furthermore, the alternative to use paid government employees rather than volunteers would have a crippling fiscal impact to the state's already limited resource and likely would provide inadequate emergency service and rescue and search and rescue services to the citizens of Oregon. Now, again, I have several friends that perform these activities on their days off and several friends that aren't associated with emergency service that provide this as search and rescue as well. They were excited about the bill prior to the amendment because it finally gave them coverage they can count on. With the amendment, they're not sure what they're going to get out of this. But I want to assure you, I'm not here to tell you to vote no on this bill because, quite honestly, there's an effort in the Senate to readdress this issue. I am raising a question of alarming because I hope this bill comes back for our concurrence with that exclusion removed. Quite honestly, again, I think what we're doing, not only giving the counties a choice, we're giving a false sense of security to some very essential volunteers that we rely heavily upon for all of our citizens. And so with that being said, I'll be voting on this bill today, but following it to the Senate and hopefully have an impact on their decision. And I'd like to see this bill come back for concurrence. Thank you for your time, Mr. Speaker.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Cowan, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you. The good representative from Gresham raises, again, the issue that I mentioned was the one area of disagreement on this bill. It certainly is a matter of personal choice, I guess, or some thought on the implementation of that particular piece. I'd like to emphasize that the reason the county's organization asked for this particular amendment is because they have had in place a long-standing agreement, many of them with their search and rescue volunteers, that they would in fact provide medical insurance, something that we don't do for most of our volunteers. For those that do not, they would fall under the work and compensation piece of it. But mostly what I'd like to do is bring you back to the basic reason for this bill, and that's to outline how we designate our volunteers through the whole scope of emergency providers, of health care providers when they're called in times of emergency, to bring them under the Tort Claims Act protection. That's where the concern was. That's what drove this bill. And this bill has a designation for how one becomes an agent of a public body for purposes of that kind of protection. The other issue is somewhat secondary. It is an important issue. It can be reexamined on the Senate side, but I urge your support of this bill to keep it moving forward because the critical piece, the tort liability protection, is essential to our being able to attract a wide variety of volunteers at times of huge need. Thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Bailey votes no. Representative Call, how do you vote? Call votes no. House Bill 3021A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The chair requests unanimous consent that the next two bills, House Bills 2539 and 2839, that the rules be suspended, and those two bills, again 2539 and 2893, be taken from today's calendar and placed in their proper place on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009's third reading calendar. The carrier is excused today. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2987 relating to child care programs.
The question now rises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2987A. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good morning, colleagues. I rise today to present to you House Bill 2987A, which comes to us from the Committee on Human Services. This bill was introduced on behalf of the Oregon Commission for Child Care to promote the state's ability to track and provide some limited oversight of programs for school-aged children. The kinds of programs affected by this bill are out-of-school programs that provide youth development activities in lieu of formal licensed child care for school-aged children and youth. Currently, there is no state attention to these kinds of programs. The Oregon Commission for Child Care spent the past year discussing this issue with stakeholders across the state. The bill before us today is the product of those conversations. Essentially, the bill requires school-age programs to register with the state, which includes a nominal fee of $20. The Child Care Division of the Employment Department will maintain a database of these programs, and finally, all staff and volunteers of these programs will be required to have a criminal background check. There are three reasons I believe this bill is necessary and important. First, the bill allows us to record and track the numbers and kinds of programs providing these forms of school-age care to Oregon children. This is useful for our ability to know how our children are being cared for when they are not in school or with their parents. Second, House Bill 2987 requires school-age recorded programs to submit certain information to the state. Primarily, recorded programs under this bill would have to make sure their employees and volunteers have basic criminal background checks. While not the same level of criminal history checks that are required of registered or certified child care programs, this will help to ensure that these school-age programs are providing safe and responsible adults to care for our children. This intermediate level of scrutiny will successfully limit the cost to organizations and the child care division while still proving the check that we need to help make sure our kids are safe. And finally, this bill was brought forward to bring awareness and education to our communities about the nature and limitations of school-age care programs. The bill requires that school-age recorded programs notify parents that the program is not a certified or registered child care provider. The Oregon Commission for Child Care worked hard to engage stakeholders in the development of this bill. They held town halls in various communities throughout the state, conducted an online survey, and met with representatives from a selection of affected programs. I applaud their efforts to create a policy that puts these school-age care programs under the view of the state without putting them in a position where the policy would make compliance difficult. I urge you to support their work with your yes vote today on House Bill 2987A. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I wanted to explain my no vote in the committee. I will be voting yes today. There had been a provision taken out of the bill in committee, and it was more of a protest vote than anything, and I have subsequently introduced House Bill 3487 to take care of what I had a problem with in the bill, so I'll be voting yes. This is a very important bill. It captures a group of people providing our children with services, and they need to be under our oversight. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kotek, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Clem votes aye. Representative Nolan, how do you vote? Nolan votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Jensen votes aye. House Bill 2987A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3039, relating to qualifying renewable energy projects and declaring an emergency.
Question now rises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3039A. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 3039 comes from the Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development, and it's an appropriate committee for that to have come from because that's what 3039 is about. Long-term sustainability, confronting our climate challenge, and economic development, putting Oregonians back to work, making sure that property owners are able to install renewable energy on their homes, and ensuring that Oregon remains at the forefront and a leader in solar installation and solar technology. I want to talk to you a little bit about what House Bill 3039 does. It's in essence a simple bill. First, House Bill 3039 establishes what's commonly known as a feed-in tariff, which allows for a customer to install a solar panel on their home and sell any excess power from that panel back to the grid. Second, House Bill 3039 establishes a pilot program for the integration of solar into our electrical grid and provides an extra incentive to help make solar cost competitive. Now, why is this needed? Currently, solar has a much lower installed capacity than other types of renewable energy. Yet solar is the only kind of renewable energy that can be installed on an individual's property, making it not only a renewable resource, but also an advantage for homeowners, especially in these tough economic times. This bill helps by making solar more cost-effective and moving solar further along the economic development cost development curve to make solar overall more cost-effective. Second, this bill, there's been questions as to whether this bill is the right feed-in tariff model. What this bill does is creates a pilot program that allows for testing the feed-in tariff model and ensuring that it achieves the goals it is intended to achieve. What this does is set up a majority of solar for small facilities that are installed on residences and then allows for some facilities that are of the larger type that allow for a larger increase in solar installation. Now, there has also been some questions about is this the right extra incentives for solar? This bill establishes a test program of up to 25 megawatts. It's a small pilot program that makes sure that we're getting the incentives right here and ensures that the solar industry in Oregon gets a signal that we as a legislature are still committed to making sure that Oregon is a front runner. This bill also establishes standards for the installation of that solar that ensures that any solar that is installed is done right and is done by the appropriate contractors. Now, House Bill 3039 will not solve all of our climate change problems, but it's a step in the right direction to make sure that we are moving forward with a bill that encourages renewable energy development in Oregon, allows for the development of a technology that can greatly benefit property owners and put people to work right away, and ensures that we have a good mix in our renewable portfolio standard.
Further discussion, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
It's kind of to the bill. I support the bill. Good bill. Should pass or dry vote. Recently, in the labor press, there was an article about the manufacturers of these this technology laying off union workers in Washington and coming to Oregon. Well, if they want our tax dollars, if they want my tax dollars to be invested in this state so that they can produce this technology and make a lot of money doing it, well, then they're going to pay family wages at these jobs. Not necessarily union jobs, but at least family wages. And if they aren't interested in paying family wages, then let me make it very clear, if you didn't see YouTube recently, then I'm not interested in investing our tax dollars in their businesses in this state, and they can go somewhere else. Because I'm tired of handing out money to rich people who aren't interested in paying family wages and benefits in this state. Good bill. I hope I've made myself clear in case people missed it on YouTube, and if I wasn't clear enough on YouTube. Good bill. Should pass. Urge your vote.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just wanted to explain my no vote.
To the bill?
Yes, to the bill. Thank you. Feed-in tariff, as I understand it, this is where a customer, a resident, decides to put up solar panels, solar array on their roof or wherever, and then the electric company has to buy it from them at a premium, and they're guaranteed that rate for a period of time. There was no discussion as to if rates would go up. It was only a discussion of how much and when. And this being a pilot program just puts the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. And that's, I don't think, a good thing for our ratepayers. I think somebody needs to speak up for them.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is This is a good bill. I will be a yes vote on this bill. I particularly appreciate the support for a feed-in tariff model, which will have the effect of promoting distributed generation. This is critical to helping reduce our reliance on coal and natural gas as a source of power. I am concerned about one provision of this bill that I hope we'll take note of, particularly as I suspect we may see requests or suggestions like this in the future, and that is the provision that allows certain projects under this bill to qualify for 2-for-1 under our renewable portfolio standard passed in 2007. As you remember, colleagues, that standard requires that 25% of the power generated and purchased by most of our state's utilities come from renewable sources, solar, wind, tidal, et cetera. Under this bill, under 3039, certain solar projects will double count towards meeting that 25% standard. And this will have the effect of reducing the total number of megawatts that meet that 25, that comprise that 25% by 2025. I expect that we can expect in the future other technologies to come along and suggest that in order to be cost effective, they need similar types of credits. It may be 2-for-1, it may be 5-for-1, it may be 10-for-1. And we just need to keep in mind, colleagues, that every time we approve one of those requests, it has the effect of reducing the total number of renewable megawatts that comprise that 25% by 2025. So the effect is of reducing that 25% to perhaps 24.5% or 24% or 23 or 22%. I'm not suggesting that this bill undermines our renewable portfolio standard, but I do want to raise the issue in hopes that we will be judicious about our use of that particular type of crediting under the renewable portfolio standard we passed last session. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Bailey, do you wish to close?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I appreciate the debate on this bill, and it is a complicated bill. And there are sections within the bill that will be addressed on the Senate side, and the Senate has been teed up to address some of those concerns. I want to correct a statement that I made about the feed-in tariff model. This, rather than selling excess capacity back to the grid, it actually allows for sale of all the energy back to the grid at a market rate, and then the repurchase of the appropriate energy back off the grid. I also want to emphasize that this bill is a way to incent development of renewable energy without using taxpayer dollars. This shifts a lot of the risk onto the consumers and the utilities, and it's a small pilot project that doesn't impact Oregon's general fund, which is something we're all looking for in these budget times. I also want to address the issue of the rate increase or premium for energy. This is a very small pilot program, and the estimates are that this will have a small to negligible increase on rates that ratepayers pay. What it does do is allow for those that do want to take advantage of this program to ensure that they're able to install these panels in a way that's cost effective. I also want to just address the issue about the renewable portfolio standard and state quite clearly that I would hope that we never pass a bill in this body that undermines the renewable portfolio standard. And in my mind, the reason that solar is so important to include in any sort of incentive program is that, one, that these are Oregon jobs, and two, that solar is the only technology that can be used to directly benefit property owners. That makes it distinct from wind, from wave, from other kinds of technologies that must be installed in large installations and then sold over the grid. Solar directly benefits property owners, not only in terms of the energy, but in terms of the value to their home. Colleagues, I urge your aye vote on House Bill 3039, and we'll look forward to a bright and sunny future in Oregon.
Further discussion? Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Harker, how do you vote? Representative Harker votes no. Representative Greenlick votes aye. Representative Wingard votes no. Representative Huffman, how do you vote? Huffman votes no. Representative Richardson, how do you vote? Richardson votes no. House Bill 3039, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3171, relating to jury service.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3171A. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 3171A comes to you from your House Judiciary Committee. This is an important bill that will increase juror turnout so that our system of justice works smoothly and efficiently. This bill will improve the jury service pool by limiting second deferrals and prohibiting employers from requiring employees to use vacation or sick leave to attend jury duty. Poor juror turnout can lead to trials being set over and, in very extreme cases, can force a judge to pull people in off the street to serve as jurors, as happened in a well-publicized case in Lane County less than a year ago. More than a dozen states have enacted jury service reforms since 1986. These reforms generally include eliminating or reducing exemptions and deferments, implementing one-day, one-trial service, improving compensation, and enacting a lengthy trial fund. Oregon's jury service laws are generally well-regarded and function effectively, but there is room for improvement. This bill will increase juror turnout by mandating that a judge may allow more than one deferral of jury duty only for good cause. It further clarifies that when a person requests a deferral more than once for good cause, he or she must provide no less than 10 dates within a 6-month period during which he or she would be available to serve on a jury. The bill also requires an employer to allow an employee to take leave without pay for time spent responding to a summons for jury duty. It also prohibits an employer from requiring an employee to take vacation or sick leave to serve on a jury. This is a good bill that will improve our justice system by increasing the number of available jurors. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Garrett, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Representative Jensen? Jensen votes aye. House Bill 3171A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2366, relating to liabilities arising from residential contractor activity.
The question now arises upon third and final passage of House Bill 2366A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2366A comes to you from your Committee on Consumer Protection with a unanimous vote. The Dash 3 amendments gut and stuff the original bill with a new concept that allows a court to disallow a lien if the owner already paid the prime contractor for the materials or services that are subject to the lien. These changes are contained in Section 3 of the bill, which amends ORS 87.060. The rest of the amendments conform other parts of the lien statutes to laws, to this change, and modernize the language of the statutes. Section 3 of the bill amending ORS 86.060 is the heart. The amendments to the subsection provide that a court must disallow a lien if the owner provides that he or she paid the contractor for materials, equipment, labor, or services that are the basis for the lien. Subsection 3 also provides that the owner may simultaneously request to have the lien disallowed and request a stay while he or she files a lien complaint with the CCB. Subsection 4 combines materials of the old Sections 3 and 4 and makes a new Section 4 compatible with the modern legislative drafting standards. It does not appear to create any new law. A claim that might be triable by jury might include a claim that the contractor did negligent or defective work and that it owes the owner damage for removing or replacing the defective work. Changes to the remainder of RS 87.060 are made to modernize the language of the statute. This still allows a claim to the main contractor, but it is going to cause the subcontractors and the people who provide those materials to be really careful about the main contractor, because right now they have a claim against the other people and they're going to have to go after the main contractor now. Ask for your aye vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Everyone has voted. House Bill 2366A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill. Oh. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that House Bill 2191 be taken from today's calendar and placed in its proper place on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009 calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2306, relating to exemptions from execution and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2306. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2306 amends Oregon's judgment collection statute to allow debtors to keep more of their property exempt from claims of creditors. Creditors can collect money from unwilling debtors by suing them and them garnishing their wages or seizing their property or both. When they seize property, they sell it, pay off the secured creditors, pay the debtors the amount of the exemption that applies to that property, and then apply whatever remains to the debt. The exemptions also protect debtors' property in bankruptcy. The Oregon exemption statute has been relatively low with respect to exemptions allowed in other states, and this bill raised two of the most important exemptions in modest amounts. The homestead exemption is currently $39,600 for a couple and $30,000 for a single debtor. This will raise the homestead exemption to $50,000 for a couple and $40,000 for an individual. The bill also increases the exemption from vehicles from $2,150 to $3,000. These two exemptions are especially important, providing some stability for families in hard times and protecting debtors' means to get the, retain the job. As to the vehicles, a husband and wife could claim up to $6,000. And finally, the bill gets rid of the distinction in homestead exemptions among floating homes, manufactured dwellings, and site-built houses. From now on, the homestead exemption will apply to all three. We last raised the exemptions in 2005 by modest amounts. While the bill is certainly a benefit to debtors, it maintains Oregon exemptions at levels that will allow creditors to collect the debts they are owed. This is a reasonable bill, and it balances the interests of both parties. And I urge your support.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Representative Gilliam. Gilliam votes aye. House Bill 2306A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2383, relating to facility sales and prescribing an effective date.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2383A. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last session, we passed legislation allowing residents of manufactured home parks to form associations or co-ops to purchase their park so that they could remain in their home and keep their neighborhood intact. This bill would give added meaning to that action, giving them a better crack at buying their park. It says simply that an owner must notify the residents of intent to sell and give 14 days to the residents to come up with an offer to buy the park. If they can match the offer, their offer must be considered first. The owner will be able to sell in either case, but this bill would help existing neighborhoods stay intact and prevent the loss of some of Oregon's most affordable housing. There are about 66,000 manufactured or mobile homes in these parks in Oregon, and nearly 800 of those are in my district. This affordable housing that already exists, let's not lose it. The residents often share a strong sense of community. The social network is strong and supportive, helping people who may struggle without that network, low-income families, disabled, and elderly persons. When a park is closed, a neighborhood and a community is wiped out. This bill will help preserve neighborhoods, save pain and suffering, and save money. Since 1997, there have been 70 park closures in Oregon, a loss of 2,774 spaces. Under current law, a developer can make an offer on a park, and a landlord can agree, and the park can be cleared a year after giving notice. What happens to those residents? It's hard to say, but we can reasonably say that many of the most vulnerable residents who depend on their neighbors for helping with daily living will be unable to relocate their home to another park and unable to find suitable housing with that social network. They will likely end up moving into nursing homes or assisted living facilities at a great cost to their happiness, a cost to their health, and a cost to the state as well. The current statute requiring negotiation creates confusion for both parties on what is required of them in negotiation. While the intent might sound good, it's not clear. This bill will clarify the situation by allowing the Association of Tenants a time period for purchasing the park following delivery of the notice of sale. Both parties, residents and park owners, admit that the current law isn't very good, and both parties have agreed they want to work on this. This bill isn't perfect either, but you'll notice that there's a future date for implementation, January 1st, 2012. One party would rather not have a deadline, and the other would appreciate a deadline. With this bill, we provide the legislative direction and plenty of time for the two parties to work together now to fine-tune the language and prepare something that could work even better. Preserving affordable housing is less expensive than developing new affordable housing. This bill does that. This bill can help preserve neighborhoods, save pain and suffering, and save money. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I don't really disagree with anything that the good representative from North Eugene just said, and I completely understand and appreciate her concern for low-income housing. Issues around manufactured housing involve complicated land use issues, property rights issues, and we've debated them at length here since I've been here. Here's what bugs me about going forward with this bill. In discussion in committee, there was a misunderstanding, I would say a honest and healthy misunderstanding between parties. And we recessed for a period of time, and I talked to some of the parties out in the hall. And parties representing both sides of this issue participate in what I think is an exemplary coalition, not only on this issue, but they have a long history of truly coming to the table and trying to hammer things out when it's very difficult. We had people testify, and the representative just alluded to this at the end of her opening comments. One side saying, you know, I would prefer this bill. The other side saying, we don't really want this bill. But both sides saying, we will go back to the bargaining table, if you will. We will go back to the coalition because we have a record, because we trust each other, and because it works. And either way, whatever you decide on this bill, we'll work it out. And, of course, in our wisdom, we went ahead with legislation. That's my difficulty. When we have parties who have a disagreement and have a record of working it out, who are both willing to go back to the table and not require us to move ahead, I think we ought to honor that and let them work it out. I much prefer the volunteer system of working this out than us coming in with legislation. But when in doubt, we legislate. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Bentz.
Colleagues, I agree with what was just said regarding low-income housing, the need to preserve it. In my practice of 30 years, I've had many opportunities to deal with rights of first refusal. And sadly, they cast a chill on the ability of someone to sell property. The way it really works is this. Someone comes in to buy a manufactured housing unit. It might cost between $5, $10, $30 million. And they work hard to establish the appropriate price. They then submit the price, and they wait. If someone steps in and buys the property for that price, it ruins all of that preliminary work. What this does then is someone that sees a right of first refusal in the law is much less enthusiastic about buying the housing, and it drives down dramatically the price of the housing. This is probably why, I'm guessing, the folks weren't able to get together on this particular legislation. This is not a simple matter. This is a complex matter, and it involves the way that folks try to manage their affairs and their ownership of these kinds of units. I very much would like to support low-income housing efforts. This is a bill, however, I'll be voting against for those reasons.
Further discussion? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, my parents lived before they passed away in a state that had right of first refusal in mobile home parks. The mobile home park they lived in was in an area that was becoming richer and richer, and in fact they were bordered by a country club, a golf course. That country club didn't like the mobile home park being there very much, and so they offered to buy it. Fortunately, in that state, they had right of first refusal for the tenants of the park, and they were able to save that mobile home park. Not all the residents were able to buy the shares that they needed to buy, but enough were, and in fact, my father actually bought four shares and rented to the three other people who couldn't afford it. So this is a good bill. It needs some work, but it's a good bill, and I don't want to throw out the good for the perfect. And so this is a very good bill, in my opinion, and I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this bill is a good bill, and I think it's a necessary bill. We had many folks come in and talk to us about this particular bill, and this bill is not so much about the 14-day first right of refusal going forward, but it's about the issue, and it's about making sure that this issue gets dealt with. We had people that came to us that negotiate and work with this landlord-tenant coalition saying we need a deadline to make sure this issue gets dealt with, and this is a tool that will force us to deal with this situation and come up with a better solution. That's, you notice the effective date of 2012. Make sure that if the coalition wants to tinker with this thing before it goes into effect and really come back with something, that they'll be able to do that in the 2011 session. It's a good vote. I urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nathanson, do you wish to close? Representative Nathanson does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Representative Jensen votes aye. Speaker Hunt, how do you vote? Hunt votes aye. House Bill 2383A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2434, relating to actions involving improvements to real property.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2434A. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I bring you House Bill 2434 from our House Judiciary Committee. This bill decreases the statutory of ultimate repose for large commercial structures from 10 years to 6 years. It applies to causes of action arising on or after the effective date. It exempts large commercial structures owned or manufactured by homeowners associations or associations of unit owners. It does exempt public bodies as defined by ORS 174-109. During the 2007 legislative session, we passed House Bill 3442, Commercial Construction License Reform Legislation. This bill raised the standard of practice in the commercial construction sector in an effort to prevent construction defaults from the outset. House Bill 3242 from last session, which became law, creates a distinction in statute between commercial and residential construction. The bill also increases bonding thresholds for commercial buildings, raised liability insurance amounts, and created new experience in continuing education standards, and instituted a new 2-year building wrap warranty to protect commercial owners. House Bill 3242 from last session set the stage for House Bill 2434. House Bill that we're voting on today, 2434, seeks to improve the liability insurance market by creating a comparable structure to our neighboring states and instituting a 6-year statute of repose on commercial construction projects. The bill does not apply to residential construction and homeowners association or public bodies. Originally, before the bill was drafted, we had some opposition from the counties. Colleagues, I think this is a good compromise bill and good policy, and I urge your yes vote.
Further discussion, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'll be voting against this bill on the floor, and I urge you to do the same. I believe this is a bad policy going forward. First of all, I don't know why this institution would set a separate standard for private commercial projects as opposed to projects of a similar type that are built for public agencies. To me, that makes no sense. We would have a different standard for us at the public that would allow our contracting agencies that to protect or to have protections for 10 years, and yet the private sector only 6. Commercial structures oftentimes don't have defects that show up until the 6th and 7th year, even with the new 2-year warranty on building envelope defects. A relatively high percentage of defects do not show up until the 6th, 7th, 8th years. We have many commercial owners who aren't organized, who invest their life savings in a commercial structure, and to jeopardize their life savings in that structure with a defect that will show up after the 6-year ultimate repose is expired seems to me to be bad policy. Quite frankly, building defects on commercial properties and residential properties are not on the decline. They are still increasing. Colleagues, this is a bad vote. It's a bad idea. It's bad policy. I urge an aye vote, or urge a no vote, excuse me.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Wisnett, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do. Colleagues, we had no testimony from citizens groups or investors that came in. Again, remember my comments. This is to put us in line with other states. and people are protected. I would still urge you a yes vote. We heard this was, we had a good work session on this in committee and a lot of compromise, and I think it's a good bill for the building industry and for the economy of Oregon. Thank you.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Riley, how do you vote? Riley votes aye. Representative Call, how do you vote? Call votes aye. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote? Representative Nathanson votes no. House Bill 2434A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2507, relating to completion of high school and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2507A. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2507A is a very simple bill that comes to you from the House Committee on Education. It does two things. It fixes something we did last session, and it improves on something that the Education Committee learned about this session. Last session, you all unanimously approved a bill to create statewide standards for a modified diploma in the state of Oregon for students who, due to persistent learning challenges, could not meet the regular standards of a high school diploma, and we wanted to give them something to strive for. Unfortunately, in the rulemaking process, that didn't turn out quite the way that we had hoped. It did create a modified diploma that has been helpful for some students, but not for the students who we had talked about, which were the most significantly impaired students. This bill will create a 12-credit diploma for students with the most significant kinds of learning needs. These are students who, many of whom are not currently earning any credits at all. In order to be eligible for this diploma, you would need to start taking modified assessments no later than the sixth grade in two or more areas. The bill also adds to it a fix to something we learned about while listening to testimony related to the Oregon School for the Blind. And we learned that several years ago, after the update of IDEA, Oregon opted to make students make a choice at the age of 18. If they received a diploma, they would have to forego any transition services for which they might be eligible under the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And these are the types of transition and life skill services that are offered to students with disabilities from the age to 18 to 21. And the types of students this is most likely to impact would be students who are like those that are at the Oregon School for the Blind, who may be blind and visually impaired. They may have met the requirements for graduating from high school, but under this plan, they're setting aside and choosing not to get the last couple of credits to graduate from high school so that they can have the orientation and mobility type of training, learning how to cook, learning to do the things that students with extraordinary needs may need to be and live independently. This makes no sense in a state where we are striving to make sure that every student earns a high school diploma and that most students are earning a college degree. This would not change the practice in local districts, as the same students who are currently receiving the transition services would. It's just that we would also allow them to have a diploma that they have earned rather than setting it aside. Colleagues, this is a good bill that meets the needs of some unique students in the state, and I hope you will join me in giving it an aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Gelser, do you wish to close? She does not. That's my blank. The question now arises. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those no. Opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Tomei, how do you vote? Tomei votes aye. Representative Schaffler, how do you vote? Schaffler votes aye. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote? Nathanson votes aye. Representative Gilliam, how do you vote? Representative Gilliam votes aye. That's all of them, isn't it? Those who, House Bill 2507A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2585, relating to class actions and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2585A. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2585A comes to you from your House Judiciary Committee. This bill is about making sure that wrongdoers do not keep their ill-gotten gains. Oregon consumers currently have limited access to justice under the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act when they are victimized at a relatively small financial level. Under current law, an individual consumer can recover actual damages or $200, whichever is greater. But a group of consumers is not entitled to bring a class action for that statutory $200 amount. Consumers will not enforce our consumer protection laws if the cost of enforcing the law is more than the actual harm caused. As a result, wrongdoers committing fraud against many Oregonians for small dollar amounts are unlikely to be held accountable for their actions, and in fact, they are not. The current system allows certain wrongdoers to get away with fraud because it generally costs too much for consumers to take the fraudulent actor to court. The effect of existing law is to encourage, or at least not to discourage, illegal conduct if it only causes relatively minor financial harm to an individual or a group of individuals. In many ways, present law guts the original intent of class actions. It discourages consumers from pursuing those claims that are, in fact, best suited for class action treatment: small-dollar fraud by an irresponsible corporation against a large number of people. House Bill 2585 gives Oregonians the ability to recover Unlawful Trade Practices Act statutory damages in class actions. This bill restores balance to our judicial process by allowing consumers to hold wrongdoers accountable for committing fraud while also increasing the burden of proof required by the class. By doing so, it ensures that groups of consumers who suffer small damages have an equal playing field. It is a deterrent to irresponsible businesses, providing an important tool for victims of consumer fraud to prevent others from being similarly mistreated. This is a good consumer protection bill. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I have been a plaintiff in a class action suit and didn't even know that I was. And we won. I received a check. I've still got the check in my office down in Central Point. I think it's for 37 cents. I did a little research to see how this came about. The large corporation that had to pay 10,000 checks or whatever the number was for 37 cents made that payment. The law firm got about $700,000 to bring this action in behalf of us aggrieved plaintiffs that didn't even know that we'd been aggrieved. And it was an abuse of the system, in my opinion. I think that there needs to be ways to deal with these practices. But to just say we're going to have small cases and allow law firms to bring about class action lawsuits for plaintiffs that have been, you know, maybe harmed and maybe not, but in some minor way, and generate huge attorney's fees is not, in my opinion, benefiting society. It's not benefiting the plaintiffs. It's not benefiting large corporations. It certainly does benefit those law firms that do class action lawsuits that kind of find places where they may come in and bring an action, and they have the war chest to fund such an action, which is expensive because you have to represent all these people. And then for what? So that you can get a 36 cent or 37 cent return to many, many people, and the law firm makes a huge amount of money. I think that we need to find a better way to deal with this than to merely say we're going to allow class actions in these small kind of cases, because it really doesn't help the consumer. It doesn't help e-commerce. It does help the law firms. So I'm a no vote on this one.
Further discussion. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, we discussed this and had a couple of work sessions in judiciary. You see, it's not a unanimous vote in judiciary. My opposition, I support and am a consumer. My wife does a lot of purchasing, and I sometimes feel I'm getting cheated. But this bill is my friend from Southern Oregon said, this is going to hurt. It's going to hurt the consumers because these costs for these lawsuits are going to be passed on to the consumer. That's why I was a no vote. It's anti-business and really going to be anti-consumer. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Garrett, would you wish to close?
I'll close very briefly, Mr. Speaker. To respond to the comments from my good colleague from Southern Oregon, I guess what puzzles me about them is that, as I understand his argument, the status quo is better because it leaves this money in the hands of the wrongdoing company. You may have only gotten 37 cents from your lawsuit, but if you hadn't, that wrongdoing company would have kept it. So we're certainly no worse off, and we're substantially better off by passing this legislation. I think what we need to remember is that this serves as much a deterrent function as a damages recovery function. These lawsuits, the existence of a class action remedy, will deter wrongdoing companies from defrauding Oregon consumers. It's a good bill. I urge your aye vote.
Those are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. House Bill 2585A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2702, relating to prescriptive authority for licensed psychologists and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises on third reading and final passage of House Bill 2702A. Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker and members of the House, come to you about an important bill, House Bill 2702, Prescriptive Privilege for Psychologists. This last session in the legislature, I've had the privilege of sitting in the Health Care Committee, and it's been a challenging and an enriching experience as we've talked about what we need to do to improve health care in Oregon. And there are about seven principles that I think are involved in that. Judging from the work we've been doing, we need to improve access. We need to make sure that services are of high quality, that they are safe for consumers, that efficiency is improved, that somehow they are less costly, and we need to be innovative but careful and make sure that it's been tested. And finally, we need to integrate mental health and physical health. This bill does all seven of those things. Let me address it more specifically. Access. All of us know that for psychotropic medication or access, particularly to psychiatrists, there's a real problem. There's a problem in the rural area, but frankly, there's a problem in the rural area, in the urban area. Indeed, there's a problem nationwide. We need to improve access. Adding psychologists to the mix of those who can prescribe psychotropic meds will help. It will not solve the access problem, but it will help. The second is we must be sure we do no harm, that we have high quality. Well, let's talk about this for a minute because there's much ado about this. Psychologists have PhDs in clinical psychology. That's 4 years of postgraduate experience and training. That's a very high standard. And then in order to become licensed, you must have an additional year of supervised experience. That's 5 years past college. That's why psychologists have such good reputations. because they're well-trained, they do good work. But this bill takes no shortcuts. Instead, it says if you want to prescribe psychopharmacological drugs, you need to be appropriately trained. And we're talking about a 2 years master's degree in psychopharmacology. And this isn't one of those online shortcut programs. 2 years. And then you have to have supervised experience, clinical experience, 800 hours. That's nearly a half a year. And this is on top of 2 years of experience and 5 years of previous training. That's very high standard. And your pharmacology is only in psychological medications. You're not going to be prescribing for colds. Third, is it safe? Psychological pharmacology formulary is going to be developed out of a committee with three physicians and a pharmacist and others. And it's going to be very specific to psychologically oriented mental health treatment medications. So no, you won't get your cold medicine from your psychologist or any number of other things. It'll be a limited formulary. And it's safe because psychologists have a history of being well-trained and competent and ethical people. Another part of this is psychologists, like all healthcare professionals, have ethics that say we must be careful to do no harm and we must always work within the limits of our competence. In fact, that's also a statutory requirement. And that's another safeguard here, because psychologists can't prescribe for anyone unless they have the expertise and the training to say that they are competent to do that. And incidentally, there's an added safeguard. In Section 7, Sub 3, there are special provisions for treating children, because we all know one of the things that's happening is many children are being over-medicated. And it is a very difficult and specialized area. And so there are special requirements that require supervision of a psychiatrist there. Let's talk about efficiency. You know, when you're working with a psychologist and you have to then work with a medical provider, there's duplication of effort and coordination. And it's difficult, especially since the reality is that people who are having problems that cause them to come to psychologists often have major life changes going on. And as a result, their dosage levels need to be changed fairly quickly, and sometimes their medications even changed. That ready access is an important part of this. This will put it all in that one scope. And there's another part. Efficiency is also, in the medical model, medicine is your predominant form of intervention. In the psychological model, therapy is your primary model of intervention. You want to get at the root cause. The studies to date indicate that psychologists tend to prescribe less. And I think most of us have to agree there is a very appropriate place for psychological medications. But there's also a place not to overprescribe. Psychologists are also going to be less costly. Psychologists, first of all, cost less, and they're far more accessible. And, like I just said, they're likely to prescribe less. And the duplication of working with a medical provider, except in cases where there are other physical complications, will reduce trouble and expense for people. This is also innovative. It's kind of Oregonian-like. You recall that we took that step to allow nurse practitioners to prescribe. This is the same thing. Indeed, the very model on which this is founded is on that nurse practitioner model, a model that's been tested and proven successful. Also, there are two states that have allowed psychologists to prescribe thus far, New Mexico and Louisiana. Both have had prescriptive privilege for 5 years, and we had letters from both states indicating there has not been a problem in those 5 years each, 10 years. And also the military for the last 15 years has been doing this, and they've researched this carefully. And psychologists, again, have had an exemplary experience there. And finally, we need to integrate physical health
and mental health. Studies indicate that medication alone or therapy alone are generally not the best treatment modalities for mental health issues. It's likely a combination of these two. And we've been talking a lot about mental health and physical health integration, but finally we have a bill that actually does it. I think it's time that we stop talking and we actually do it. And this is the bill that will do it. Back in 2007, many of you were here for a previous bill. It was somewhat similar. And I want to thank the good representative from North Portland for her efforts at that time to take that bill and work with it and improve it. And with her encouragement, over the interim, there was a group that worked together collaboratively with some psychiatrists. And this is a much, much improved bill. I think this provides access, high quality, is safe, efficient, less costly, innovative and tested, and integrates mental health and physical health. I encourage your support of House Bill 2702.
Further discussion? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill?
To the bill.
I rise to support 2702. I think it's a good bill and an important bill. We've been working this bill since the 2005 session in one form or another, and I've been very reluctant to support it up to this time. In fact, I probably did the most to stop it in the 2007 session because I felt it wasn't ready yet and because I really wanted to make sure there was continued opportunity for the psychology community to work with the medical community to create a training model and to put sideboards around the practice of psychology, of prescribing psychology, that would make some sense. Mostly the discussions with the medical community were, if you want to prescribe drugs, become a doctor. In a prior life as a researcher, I worked in the 60s and 70s and 80s with the development of the nurse practitioner model and with the physician's assistant model. And in those days, we heard much the same thing. If you want to practice medicine, become a doctor. Well, we found since that there are lots of models at work, and we have hundreds of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants out doing things that were thought originally to be hazardous. The fact is that any physician now can prescribe any medicine, including complex psychotropic medications. So what frequently happens is a psychologist calls a family physician up and says, my patient needs X drug. Would you prescribe X drug? And the family physician, not knowing much about psychotropic medication, says, fine, I'll write the prescription. And that's the way it works. And that's not a very good way. What we propose here is to create a small cadre of psychologists who, with a rigid training program, including both coursework and field work, learning about the complex world of psychotropic drugs, will be able to prescribe these drugs in both rural and urban settings. It seems to me, after careful consideration, and in spite of the dozens of emails I've received from physicians pointing out Western civilization as we know it will come to an end if we pass this bill, I think we're moving forward, and I think this is a bill that's both safe and effective and will benefit our patients throughout the state. I urge you to vote yes on House Bill 2702. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
Bill. To the bill.
Colleagues, psychologists can be successfully trained to prescribe safely and effectively. Prescribing psychologists enhance access to mental health care as well as enhance quality of care. Prescribing psychologists in other places have a proven track record of integrating therapy with appropriate medication to produce better outcomes with less risk. I think that most of those who have looked at this bill or have looked at the area that we're discussing are unaware of the fact that clinical psychologists in their normal course of treatment take courses in psychopharmacology. I took courses in psychopharmacology in my initial training to be a psychologist in the first place as part of my PhD program. And this is the part of the normal course of training. It is well understood in psychology that mental health and physical health are not separate things, but are all connected with each other and involved with each other in all aspects of our lives. It is also well understood by psychologists that the primary mode of intervention that psychologists use is behavioral, not involving medications. The description that the good representative from the historic Tualatin County told us about is altogether too true. And this bill actually will improve the prospects for patients who need the help both of behavioral psychology and psychotherapy and counseling and in medication. I want to tell you quickly about two stories about two prescribing psychologists. One is Elaine Orabona Foster, who is a U.S. Air Force medical officer based in Florida. She was trained as a prescribing psychologist as part of the Defense Department demonstration project. The project was launched because the U.S. military, like the rest of us, lacked enough psychiatrists and psychiatric nurses to address mounting mental health needs of American servicemen and servicewomen. Dr. Foster admits to some initial trepidation about prescribing dangerous mind-altering drugs, but since she earned her certificate in 1996 to prescribe, she has written more than 100,000 prescriptions without adverse outcomes or malpractice complaints. And I want to tell you about one of her cases in which she said, I treated a case recently involving a young 24-year-old woman who had returned from deployment. She had been hospitalized for suicidal behaviors and was transferred to me on 12 different antidepressant, anti-anxiety, mood stabilizing, and sleeping pills. I was personally aghast at the idea that such a young woman with barely any mental health history had been placed on so many medications. She appeared to be sleepwalking when I saw her for the first appointment, eyes half closed, slurring her words. I immediately began lowering, then discontinuing her medication regimen, and by the end of her second week as an outpatient, she was down to 3 medications. And then she says, our strength as psychologists is that we understand the value of behavioral treatments. My defense psychologist colleagues have already demonstrated that we are more likely to utilize psychotherapy as the mainstay of treatment and to use medication sparingly and judiciously. Elaine Levine, as a prescribing psychologist who served as a training director for the New Mexico State University Master's Degree Program in Psychopharmacology, notes that there are now 20 prescribing psychologists in New Mexico. She says, I can speak from experience that allowing psychologists with appropriate training the right to prescribe can greatly enhance access to care. Within Las Cruces, I traveled to nursing homes and worked with patients whose medication might otherwise be prescribed by a general physician through a telephone consultation. Again, by really listening to patients using integrated model of care in both psychotherapy and psychotropic intervention, when they're carefully combined, patients show much progress with less medication and less possibility for side effects. Colleagues, this bill has been carefully worked for a number of years. It is ready. It is time. I urge an aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to echo the comments of the good representatives who've spoken already about the importance of this bill, and that this has been a bill that has been worked very hard. As a freshman chair of a subcommittee in 2007, this bill came before me, and scope of practice issues are always
a challenge because you have very specific differing viewpoints coming before the legislature saying and asking us to determine some very complicated issues and put into law good policy that will protect Oregonians. And we worked on that bill in 2007. There was a work group. I worked with Representative Flores at the time with the psychologists and the psychiatrists to improve that bill. We did not end up getting that bill passed in 2007. But those groups came back together in the interim, and they worked, and they actually improved that bill. And we have increased clinical oversight, increased practicums, increased sideboards to make sure that Oregonians will be safe if we implement prescribing authority for psychologists. And there were two people who testified in 2007 who have stuck with me. One was a young man whose brother was suffering from mental illness. And he desperately asked us to provide more access for his brother to be able to have a combination of good therapy and access to prescription medications that he was unable to get. And there was a lot of pain and suffering in that family because of lack of access to quality mental health services. And he asked us to pass this bill. I also remember a primary care physician from Eastern Oregon who was saying, I want someone in my community that I can work with that can help me provide the best mental health services. I prescribe a lot of medications. I don't want to be doing this. I want a psychologist in my community that I can work with who also has that prescriptive authority so we can provide the best care possible in our community. Those two individuals have stuck with me since 2007. I believe this bill is stronger. It will provide the safeguards that we all want to make sure are there for Oregonians who are seeking services with a psychologist who would pursue prescriptive authority. I believe we will only see a handful of psychologists across the state who will want to take advantage of this. But when they do, there will be increased access and increased access to quality mental health services in their community because of it. And I urge your aye vote because this is the right thing to do. It's the right time to do it, and this is a good bill, colleagues. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you. Colleagues, I was a no vote in committee on this bill, and I will be a humble no vote on this vote this morning. Before I say anything, I want to congratulate the good representative from southwestern Clackamas County. He has been a very articulate and intelligent champion on this issue. He's worked very hard, and I know he's passionate about it. Colleagues, I'm not going to urge you to vote yes or to vote no. I'm only going to urge you to vote your conscience and explain my no vote. As has been described already, we had hours of testimony from both psychologists and psychiatrists. And I have to tell you that if the vote were who came across as more likable, more accessible, better discussers of the issue, it was the psychologist. I say this with some hesitancy, but it needs to be said. The psychiatrists in this particular issue came across with an arrogance at times that was very disconcerting. Having said that, the psychiatrists are, without exception, were trained medical professionals with years and years and years of experience. They said two things. Well, they said one thing: it will be harmful, and they went on to describe why this legislation will be harmful. So it put me in a situation, Mr. Speaker, as a citizen legislator, as somebody trained in finance and construction, to having to look at psychiatrists in the face and say, either A, you're lying, or B, you don't know what you're talking about from a healthcare perspective. Mr. Speaker, I'm not in a position to say either A, they're lying, or they don't know what they're talking about. So once again, that was my no vote, and that's why I will be a humble no vote today.
Further discussion, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill?
To the bill, yes. I'm also on the healthcare committee and sat through many hours of testimony on this issue. And did hear, as a good representative from West Lynn just mentioned, negative testimony by psychiatrists talking about the harm that would come from this new program. What we did not hear was any examples of harm that has come from this program in the other states in which this program already exists.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kennemer, do you wish to close? He does.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, members, for a good discussion.
I think this is a precedent-setting bill. No, a handful of psychologists will not change the world, but they'll change the world for a handful of people that they will see. And that's been the joy of my experience as a psychologist across the years. I used to say my job was making the world a little bit better one person at a time. You know, there are questions of risk and accusations that were funded by the pharmaceutical companies and all of this kind of nonsense. But when you really boil it down, I think it's there. We've talked about the sideboards. We've talked about what needs to happen in Oregon to have better health care. Improved access, improved quality, safety, more efficiency, less expense, innovative yet proven, and an integration of physical and mental health. I think this does that. I think we live in a world where 85% of psychopharmacological drugs are prescribed by general physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners. Frankly, many who lack expertise as mental health specialists. This bill puts 2.5 years of pharmacological training and limits them only to psychopharmacological agents in the hands of people who already have 5 years of training. This will be safe. This will make a difference. I urge your aye vote, and I thank you for your attention. And, Mr. Speaker, on that note, I do need to record a possible conflict of, a potential conflict of interest.
State your conflict.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I am a licensed psychologist, although I am currently inactive. I wish I were starting my career over because I'd love to add this to my resume, but I do not anticipate it, but it could have a financial impact, and therefore I think it's appropriate that I register potential conflict of interest.
So noted for the record.
I urge your aye vote.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Gelser, how do you vote? Gelser votes no. House Bill 2702A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2790, related to Board on Public Safety Standards and Training.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2790A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2790 passed out of the Judiciary Committee unanimously. It increases the membership of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. It adds additional members to the policy subcommittees. It provides a process for amending an administrative law judge's orders. House Bill 2790 initially aimed at both restructuring the makeup of the boards as well as the hearings process. The amendment scales back the overhaul and instead adds one person, a non-management parole and probation officer, to the board. The amendments also restructure some of the policy committees. Two non-management policy officers are added to the policy committee. Two non-management correction officers are added to the corrections policy committee. The amendments also provide that after the administrative law judge issues a decision, the board will have an opportunity to amend the final order. The two sides worked out their difference and came to a consensus which is encompassed in the -4 amendment, which is the bill. Ask for your aye vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. House Bill 27. Representative Hunt, how do you vote? Representative Hunt votes aye. House Bill 2790A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2821, relating to use of vacation leave during period of family leave.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2821A. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2821A comes to you today from your Committee on Business and Labor. House Bill 2821A provides employees who take family medical leave the option of taking eligible accrued paid time off or not. Presently, employers may mandate the use of paid vacation time. In those instances where an employee takes multiple forms of accrued paid time off under family medical leave, such as vacation and sick leave combined, House Bill 2821A reserves for employers the right to determine the order in which such multiple forms of paid leave are taken. Colleagues, House Bill 2821A provides employees the option of using any eligible accrued paid time off during family medical leave. I urge your support of the bill on that basis. Thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, what we're doing here is we're getting away from federal guidelines on this issue. We are, in fact, allowing an employee to take their family leave, turn around, come back in, and request paid vacation. You could do that within a day. You could accumulate not only your family leave and use that, but turn around and get 3 or 4 weeks paid vacation on top of it. I think this in itself is detrimental not only to business in this state, but more importantly, to jobs itself. We have to be very careful of what we do in this building, and I'm not sure that we are. I urge your no vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Witt, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Kenemer, how do you vote? Representative Kenemer is no. Richardson is no. House Bill 2821A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2874, relating to victims of crime.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2874A. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill. Colleagues, House Bill 2874 comes to you from your Judiciary Committee. The bill allows crime victims to assert the right to a speedy trial. It provides that the victim's assertion of a speedy trial rights does not supersede the defendant's constitutional rights. It also creates a procedure for asserting that right to a speedy trial by giving victims an opportunity to participate in the pretrial process. As we know, a prolonged pretrial wait can cause mental and emotional strain for crime victims and their families. This bill has no fiscal or revenue impact. It is a good bill and deserves your aye vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Barker, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those no. Opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Call, how do you vote? Representative Call, how do you vote? Representative Call. Off the floor. House Bill 2874A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2970, relating to expanding utilization of the Earned Income Tax Credit and declaring an emergency.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2970A. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Federal Earned Income Credit, or EIC, sometimes called EITC, was enacted in 1975 with the policy goal of refunding payroll taxes to certain low-income taxpayers. The Oregon EIC follows the same pattern as the federal credit and piggybacks on the federal EIC. The amount of the state and federal credit varies with income and number of children. Nearly two-thirds of the families who receive Oregon's EIC earn less than $20,000 a year. This bill is to help the Oregonians who are not receiving the credit they've earned. Not everyone who is eligible to receive the EIC is claiming and receiving it. Two predominant reasons are these: failure to claim it on the tax return and simply not filing a tax return. Some people mistakenly assume that since they don't earn enough money to pay taxes, there's just no harm in not filing a return. Or they don't realize that they could get some of their prepaid taxes back. Or they're unsure how to file and discouraged that getting help will cost money. As a member of Ways and Means, I've been keenly interested in making sure we maximize federal dollars coming into Oregon. The reasons are obvious: more direct assistance for Oregonians, reduce the burden that Oregon carries on its own, and benefit from the federal dollars that would now be circulating as the money is used to buy goods and services in the state. Consider how hard we work on the demand for funding food banks, emergency and low-cost housing, and health care. Some of the people needing those services are likely eligible to receive this Earned Income Tax Credit. Oregonians for Working Families tells us, quote, "By helping publicize the EITC, you can help your constituents access tax credits they deserve. No eligible Oregonian should miss out on the EITC or other tax credits." Children First for Oregon says, quote, "All of the state and federal tax credits available to families and businesses are underutilized. An estimated 25% of families eligible for this credit do not file and receive their benefits. Oregon should increase its outreach efforts and expand the availability of free tax preparation for low-income families." Finally, we hear from Oregon's Hunger Relief Task Force, quote, "Increasing the state EITC percentage will help low-wage workers and our state. Low-income families often live paycheck to paycheck. Tax relief will be spent on food, housing, health care, and utilities." The EIC is important for about 1 out of 7 taxpaying families. Studies show that these families primarily spend their refunds on bills, rent, utilities, groceries, and other commodities. So much of this money is recycled through Oregon communities. For the 2006 tax year, the federal EIC return to Oregon was $362 million. For that tax year, 206,000 families claimed the EITC, but that was only 72% of the families eligible. If we achieve a 10% increase in usage, there is the potential for more than 20,000 more claimants and bringing in nearly $36 million more federal dollars to Oregon. We have several state agencies that do or can provide information about this, and a number of private organizations that do. What we don't have is a concerted, coordinated approach to ensure that we develop a good comprehensive outreach plan. This bill will do that. It provides clear direction to state agencies to work together and collaborate to increase the number of Oregonians claiming the EITC. We should eliminate duplication of effort as each agency and organization writes and rewrites the materials one at a time and schedules information campaigns. We should be able to achieve economies of scale, and we should be sure taxpayers hear about the assistance that's available to them. Let's help them and the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness get the attention deserved to meet this challenge. So I ask for your yes vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Nathanson, do you wish to close?
No, thank you.
She does not. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Widener, how do you vote? He votes aye. House Bill 2970A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2988, relating to voluntary central background registry.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2988A. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Good morning, colleagues. I rise today for House Bill 2988, which comes to you from the Committee on Human Services with a due pass recommendation. It was brought to us by the Oregon Commission for Child Care and the representatives from North Portland and rural Deschutes County. House Bill 2988 is an attempt to improve and simplify oversight of individuals who work or serve as volunteers in multiple agencies. This bill creates a voluntary background registry as a clearinghouse that can be used for individuals who work or volunteer in several child-serving agencies to avoid the fees and hassles of multiple background checks. Instead of a brand new background check for each new hire or volunteer, the state can save time and money by keeping a voluntary registry of background checks. The registry is completely voluntary and would create an efficient, cost-effective background check system for the population working with children. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I voted no in committee, and I think the clean box is a great idea. Hopefully we can implement it. The problem is that in conversation in committee, it was clear to me that the details have not been worked out. There's issues of privacy, who's going to have access to this database, what's going to be there, and quite clearly these folks have not done all of the homework, and I will be voting no, urging the Senate to ask some really tough questions going forward. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Van Orman, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
She does not. Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Beyer, how do you vote? Representative Beyer votes aye. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Representative Clem votes aye. Representative Stiegler, how do you vote? Representative Stiegler votes aye. Representative Wingert, how do you vote? Winger votes aye. House Bill 2988A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3116, relating to financing for community college districts.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3116. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 3116 amends ORS Chapter 341 regarding the expansion of community college districts. The measure permits community colleges such as Rogue Community College and Blue Mountain Community College to incur bonded indebtedness through bond elections by district-wide vote in the same manner as other community colleges. Currently, Rogue Community College and Blue Mountain Community College may only incur bonded indebtedness through bond questions taken to each service district separately. This bill only affects Rogue Community College and Blue Mountain Community College, and I'd appreciate your aye vote. The chief sponsor, co-sponsor of this bill is a representative from Medford. Any problems or questions on this bill should, of course, be directed to him. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Buckley, do you wish to close? He does not. The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3116. Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? He votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Jensen votes aye. House Bill 3116, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3219, relating to smoking.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3219. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 3219 establishes signage requirements for the smoke-free workplace law for hotel and motel establishments. Folks, the Public Health Department has told us this can be done by rule. We want this bill to move along so that our good friends down in Ashland and other places where they have theatrical productions will be able to amend the bill and allow them to use smoking tools in productions. My wife and daughter love the theater, and I get the opportunity to go with them on occasion and enjoy some pieces, but not all. But this is a good bill. Urge your vote.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Schaffler, do you wish to close? He does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Nolan, how do you vote? Representative Nolan, how do you vote? Nolan votes aye. Representative Jefferson Smith, how do you vote? Representative Smith votes aye. Representative Jensen votes aye. House Bill 3219, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3273, related to domestic violence programs.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3273A. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, today I bring House Bill 3273 to you from the wonderful Human Services Committee. This bill provides authority for the Department of Human Services to contract with domestic violence service providers to place domestic violence advocates at child welfare offices, and it sets out the model by which this cooperative service delivery should be implemented. The purpose of locating advocates at child welfare offices is to provide in-depth safety, planning, advocacy, and ongoing support to adult domestic violence victims whose children come in contact with the child welfare system. It also provides support and consultation to child welfare caseworkers in creating family case plans involving victims and perpetrators. So why the focus on domestic violence in child welfare cases? Statewide statistics show that domestic violence is a safety threat in over one quarter of all child abuse cases in Oregon. Domestic violence, along with substance abuse and mental health concerns, is one of the top three drivers for all child abuse cases. We must find a way to address this statewide problem. Providing safety and support to parents who are victims is necessary if we are to protect children living in those homes when there is violence. Unless safety issues are resolved, children cannot return home safely. The needs of parents who are victims of domestic violence are complex and include safety planning, counseling, safe housing, legal assistance with protection orders, and more. DHS caseworkers are challenged in responding to the intense needs of these parents. Having advocates on site ensures that parents who are victims get the support they need. Pilot projects in Oregon have had great success. Child welfare caseworkers reported that parents had better access to services, that victims were more likely to successfully deal with the experience of violence, and that parents were able to keep safety plans for their children. Caseworkers also were better able to keep children safely with their own parent rather than placing them in foster care. This bill establishes the model by which focused domestic violence advocacy services should be provided when state or grant funds eventually become available. The original version of the bill, drafted during better economic times, proposed to require that DHS place advocates in every office across the state. While such a mandate would be best practice, implementation statewide is not feasible given our current economic climate. This bill, as amended, outlines the model that has worked across the nation, and it carries no fiscal, but it does carry a smart public safety policy. I urge your aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Tomei, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
She does not. Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Wingert, how do you vote? He votes aye. House Bill 3273A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 3463, relating to biodiesel and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3463A. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just briefly, 464A comes to you from your House Environment and Water Committee. Passed out of committee with only one uninformed dissenting vote. the importance, I think, to note here is that in the 07 legislature, this legislature made a deliberate attempt to encourage the development of alternative fuels for us to have in the state of Oregon. As part of the effort that was made, to advance the idea of alternative fuels, there was a real priority put on using Oregon product to produce these fuels, at least as the infant industry got started. There was a little bit of confusion apparently in the bill, and one of my constituents and a firm in Portland were having trouble marketing the biodiesel they had. They brought this bill to us as a correction for that. This is a good bill. It carries on the tradition that we had established in the 07 legislature should pass. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise today on behalf of the uninformed and courageous caucus to oppose this bill simply because I think it does exactly, at least in one part of it, does exactly the opposite of what the representative who, for some unknown reason, chose District 58 instead of last year's Loaves and Fishes District, as his moniker, said. And that is this. We are all very excited about renewables, most of us on this floor. I am. You're going to hear a bill that I've teamed with the representative from parts of Eugene, West-ish, I think, and I. I'm very excited about renewables. But we get a little bit of under-the-dome thinking, and because we're excited and because we've decided that we've gone green, that we have implemented these policies. And all we've done is started the policies. And this, to me, is an example of a policy we started. And now we're pulling out provisions of that policy from last time before they have a chance to work. This could very well limit competition, and I think it's the wrong direction to go. And I would urge a no vote. Let the industry catch up on this provision, and don't damage competition. So I would urge you to take a look at this and not overreact, but rather let the policies that we put in place play out. Let's all be excited about the renewables and certainly biodiesel, but let's don't undo what we've done before it has a chance to work. There is a, this is probably not appropriate on the floor, but his criticism wasn't exactly appropriate. So there is a little wagering going on between the two of us. And if in fact, I succeed with my compelling arguments today, I've made a promise. It's a monetary promise to him, and I make a promise to all of you that if we defeat this bill, there will be no more remonstrances this session from this desk. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion. Further discussion. Representative Nolan.
Does the bill have to stay dead? Mr. Speaker, potential conflict.
State the conflict.
A member of my household is an investor in a biodiesel fuel company that may benefit from this bill.
So noted for the record. Further discussion, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to address one point within this bill that has come up within the testimony. We worked very hard, and I salute the leadership of Representative Jensen, to ensure that we came up with a bill that was a compromise bill that addressed all the concerns that were out there. And in doing so, Representative Jensen, I didn't refer to you by your handle, the representative from District 58. I salute his leadership on this. And the one part of this bill that I think deserves some attention is the compromise that was reached on renewable diesel. Now, this bill establishes a moratorium on renewable diesel for 2 years to make sure that Oregon industry can remain competitive. This bill is about Oregon jobs, and it does not exclude a technology. It simply says time out on a technology that is not yet available in Oregon, is not yet ready for market, and to ensure that large out-of-state petroleum interests don't come in and squash Oregon industry before it has a chance to get off the ground. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion? Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Just briefly, my able chief co-sponsor has already provided all the arguments. I just wanted to say how important this is to economic development within the Salem area. There's a great facility that has been seeded by Willie Nelson and a variety of other local investors. And if you like Willie, you're going to like this bill, I think. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Jensen, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I think all has been said about the bill, and the uninformed member of the House Environment and our Water Committee. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Springer, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Wingert, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Jefferson Smith votes aye. Representative Riley votes aye. For Representative Bruin, to what purpose do you rise?
I wish to change my vote.
Representative Bruin wishes to change his vote.
I tried, but from no to aye. Wasn't even close. We had an opportunity.
That's right. So noted. House Bill 3463A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2727, relating to records of concealed handgun licenses.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2727A. Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill. Colleagues, I come before you today urging your aye vote on House Bill 2727, the A engrossed version. And first of all, I wanted to give you a little background as to the history of this bill. It arose out of a situation that came about down in Jackson County regarding the release of information of a concealed handgun license permit applicant. As a result of a request for this person happened to be a teacher, and as a result of requests by the Medford Mail Tribune, there was a resulting series of legal proceedings by which the circuit court down there determined, under what some have termed a very tortured analysis, that the information could not be released. However, it was, I think, recognized by all that what was better was to provide some more certainty to the situation than what this court opinion provided. I would note as well that that court opinion is currently on appeal with the Oregon Court of Appeals. Before getting into the crux of this legislation, I would like to acknowledge the assistance, and first of all, I want to acknowledge that this was not my bill originally. I was not an original sponsor. I came into this a little bit later in the game in an effort to try to get to a compromise that I thought was workable and that was a win-win kind of situation. This was, I believe, Representative Thatcher is the original sponsor of House Bill 2727, and Representative Wisnett as well worked long and hard, as well as Representative Barker, who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee. What this bill in its current form attempts to do is to strike a balance between the recognition of the very legitimate concerns and interests of law-abiding citizens of this state to protect their privacy and security from unwarranted inquiry, i.e. concealed handgun license applicants and permittees, with the nearly four-decade-long history in Oregon of acknowledging the public's right to follow the actions of its public officials via its public records laws. Oregon has rightfully earned the reputation as being a sunshine state when it comes to our open records laws in this state. And in this particular case, the records being revealed and the actions being scrutinized are those of the granting of the privilege to carry a concealed handgun license. So, again, what I attempted to do in drafting the Dash 8 amendments to this bill, which were ultimately adopted unanimously by your Judiciary Committee, was to balance those two very compelling public concerns in this state. In order to do this, rather than exclude these records, i.e. the application and the permit of a concealed handgun license holder from the public records law, which would be unprecedented, I might add, what we sought to do was to provide the most compelling exemption possible for these applicants. And by doing so, we placed them under an exemption under 192.502, which there are two sets of exemptions by statute. 501 exemptions are where
somebody can show, such as a newspaper or a citizen, can show that there is a public interest to disclose the public record. A 502 exemption is a much more restrictive kind of exemption in that they are essentially without, as in this case, showing by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest outweighs the interests of the holder of those records being released. So in this particular instance, we opted for the more restrictive exemption, which except under a showing of clear and convincing evidence to either the custodian of the records or ultimately the circuit court, which would be the ultimate determiner of whether or not these records were eligible to be released, the applicant for a concealed handgun license would be protected from having that information released. One of the issues that arose during the process of negotiating or trying to come to some kind of consensus on how to protect these very legitimate concerns was how do you notify and give advance notice that somebody has the right to have this information protected. So under Section 2, I believe it is, of the bill, there is required to be placed in the application, and I might add here that the applications under current statute are supposed to be fairly, they're supposed to be essentially the same throughout the state so that you can go from county to county and recognize the information that's contained therein. But as part of the notice that would be provided, there would be a notice that this information could be released under certain circumstances, and if the applicant wishes to have that information kept confidential, then from disclosure, then they need to, then they request that they be notified by the custodian. In this case, the custodian in all situations is the county sheriff, so they would request that they be given notification of any request to release those that application. We further provided for the protection of the applicant by indicating that if a applicant requests that that their information be kept confidential, that in making a determination as to whether or not the public interest by clear and convincing evidence outweighs the rationale to keep the records confidential, that the custodian must take into consideration any and all information provided to them by the applicant or the affected holder of the application. So the applicant has the right to have input into the process to make it known to the custodian what their concerns are, what the compelling interest in maintaining their privacy is. I would also indicate here that some questions have arisen regarding ultimately if a court or the custodian of the records, and my guess is in most of these situations, you're going to find a sheriff upholding the confidentiality of these applicants and these license holders, and this will probably end up in circuit court if the requester ultimately doesn't like that conclusion. And there's been some concern about, well, if ultimately these records are released, is the home address, telephone number, email, social security number, is that released along with it? ORS 192.445 currently has a process by which the subject of a public record, in this case it would be the concealed handgun license holder, an applicant, that they can request that their address, their home address, their home telephone number, and electronic mail address be withheld from any of those records that are ultimately released. As to the social security number, we're checking, but I believe that federal law controls there, and that social security number and utilization of that is controlled by federal law. And it's very limited when and where you can release that information and how that information can be used. But what I would add here, legal counsel is checking this out just to make sure that our interpretation is correct. But if that's not the case, then that's one of those things that can be very easily added under in any kind of Senate amendment to this provision. Ultimately, I believe what we achieved here was a good balance, as I said, a good compromise between recognizing that citizens of our state, good law-abiding folks who happen to be gun owners, of which my husband is one and my son and probably many people in this chamber, people who have no desire, no reason to want their information released, to balance that with the public interest in those few but compelling circumstances under which there may be a compelling public interest to release that information. So with that, I'd be happy to address any questions, and I would urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier?
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you very much. First time I've heard Oregon referred to as the Sunshine State. I appreciate that.
On my side of the mountain, it is.
Very good. Very good. So under this bill, if a voter wants to find out if his or her elected sheriff has granted a concealed handgun license to a particular member of the community, what would he or she have to do?
Under this bill?
Yeah, if this bill were to pass.
If this bill were to pass, it would, the voter would have to file a request with the custodian of the record, i.e. the sheriff or the sheriff's designee, requesting that information be released. Now, you couldn't just make a general request to anybody and everybody. I mean, you'd have to have a particular person that you're making the request about.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Another question of the carrier?
Another question of the carrier. Does she yield?
Yes.
She does.
So we know that many victims of domestic abuse never file a criminal complaint. Oh, did you?
Let me correct something.
Another clarification?
Clarification.
Are you a question? You were asking questions. What is your question? State your question, and then we can decide. Okay.
Okay. I will finish my question and then be glad to listen to the... So we know that many victims of domestic violence never file a criminal complaint. If this bill were to pass, would a victim of domestic abuse have the right to know whether his or her abuser had a concealed handgun license? And if so, how long would the process take?
And I'll clarify my response to your first question as well in this response. First of all, the process is initiated by a request from a citizen or an organization such as a newspaper. So that initiates a process. But I want to be very clear. The information will never be released unless either the custodian of the record or ultimately a circuit court or a court of, court of appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court were to determine that by clear and convincing evidence, the public interest outweighed the interest of the concealed handgun license holder or applicant. So that burden would have to be met, and the custodian or ultimately the court would have to make a determination that that concealed handgun license permittee's interests were outweighed by clear and convincing evidence by the public interest. So in your instance regarding the domestic violence victim, they would certainly have the right to request that information. In the process of requesting the information, my understanding is generally there's some rationale or reason for the request, though that's not required, but they could certainly make their argument as to why they meet that burden, why there's clear and convincing evidence that that information should be released to them. How long it would take, the statute currently speaks to, and this provision doesn't change it at all, reasonable time. So whatever reasonable is determined to be, once a decision has been made by the custodian, then there's statutory time limits as to when that can be appealed, either up to the court or in the case of if it's a designee of the sheriff, like they have one of their deputies who makes that decision, then it's appealed to the district attorney's office and they have 10 days to make a determination.
Thank you very much. To the bill?
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'm going to vote against this bill, and I'm first to describe a couple of reasons why. These are not the reasons I'm going to vote against the bill, and then talk about the reasons why I am going to, in fact, vote against the bill. I'm not voting against this bill because the arguments made by many advocates seem to contradict directly what we've been hearing for years, that if criminals know that a particular homeowner has a firearm, they're less likely to invade that home. The arguments that we're hearing in support of this bill contradict that directly, but that's not why I'm going to oppose this bill. I'm not going to vote against this bill also because it directly contradicts the argument that guns are merely tools, and it's people that kill people, not guns. For according to the logic behind this bill, ownership of a concealed handgun license increases the chances that someone will be a crime victim. The very act of owning a gun, according to the logic of this bill, increases the chance that you're going to be a victim of crime, some kind of home invasion. I will be voting against this bill for three primary reasons. Number one, first, no compelling need has been established at all. The Medford Mail Tribune did not print the names and the addresses of all the people with the licenses. And we have heard no other compelling reason why there is actually a problem here. No media outlet has printed the names and addresses. The court actually sided in favor of those who are concerned about the display of these names. This is the classic solution in search of a problem. So that's number one reason I'm not going to vote it. Secondly, sheriffs are elected public officials. And we talk about sunshine, and we patted ourselves in the back last week to talk about the open books and how accountability and transparency is what we are all about. Elected officials, sheriffs, if a voter wants to know whether or not a sheriff is responsibly handing out these permits or licenses, not based on the pure number, not because they gave 560, but they want to know, because they know specific people in the community they would be very concerned about. Under this bill, it would be a very difficult information to obtain. Third and most important, this bill places victims of domestic abuse at risk, and it denigrates their rights while privileging the rights of people with concealed weapons who might be the abuser. Now, correlation does not provide causation, and there are many responsible, but I worry about the victim who is intimidated and wants to know if that abuser has a concealed license. To use a popular culture example, and I'll close with this, let's take a couple. We'll call them Chris and Rihanna. This bill protects the rights of Chris at the expense of the rights of Rihanna, the abuse victim. In a sense, the abuse victim, the person who's concerned about the threats, takes a back seat. And although we talk about the Sunshine State and transparency, I'm afraid that Rihanna would be left out in the cold, in the rain, with no umbrella. I urge your no vote.
Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
I think, to the bill.
To the bill.
I think if Macbeth were here today, he might say that this bill is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But I want to back up a little bit and talk about Oregon's public records laws. They were created during the Watergate era to keep government officials and government bodies accountable. Oregon didn't even issue concealed handgun licenses until 16 years later. Back then, the information for those licenses should have been made off limits, and it should be that way today, but it's not. And House Bill 2727 doesn't quite get us there either. Let's remember these license holders did not ask to be put in the public spotlight, hence the term concealed. They did not ask to have all sorts of personal information about themselves and their family on file at the sheriff's office. But in order to get a CHL, they had to fill out the forms. They did not ask to be required to get police permission to exercise a basic right. They never asked to have to pay a fee so they and their loved ones could feel safe. Now it's no longer a right, but a privilege, and they're charged for it. And all that personal information they give to the police is now subject to being a public record. It's not right. These people are not public bodies. They are not public agencies. They are not conducting the people's business. Government records should be about government programs and not whether a single mom living in a remote area of the state has a CHL to protect herself and her children. Or how about that single mom from Medford trying to protect herself from an abusive ex-husband? As told you earlier, yes, that was the case in Medford that brings us to where we are today. As part of that case, a county judge said it was okay for the local newspaper to have some of the CHL records, and that case is now on appeal. The sheriff in that county, regarding that case, related to that case, Mike Winters, had this to say when we told him the bill was going to be amended. He said, "I request that it remain in the original form or as close to that as possible. Our citizens' right to privacy must be protected. Nearly 105,000 letters were sent statewide, with almost as many returned, and the people spoke clearly. They do not want their information to be public record." Now, what he was talking about was those surveys that sheriffs sent all over the state to CHL holders last fall. In talking to the local NRA representative, he said that he's not happy with the outcome of the bill, not opposed, but not enthusiastically supporting. We asked the Oregon Firearms Federation what they thought about amending the bill to where it is today. We received a letter from them saying, "Oregon Firearms is not interested in a bill which will create the illusion of privacy protection without reality." Back to the pay-to-play issue for a minute. Concealed handgun license holders are responsible gun owners. They are the law-abiding citizens in our society. There are 109,000 in Oregon, and the number who get their licenses revoked every year is less than one half of 1%, way lower than even the lowest level crime rate for even misdemeanor offenses in Oregon. Not only do these people pay a fee, they have to be over 21, they undergo perhaps the most extensive background checks in the country, including fingerprinting. They also have to take a certified training course. I'm not, and you should not, be worried about these gun owners. I am worried, and you should be worried, about the gun owners who are not following the law, mainly the bad guys out there who are out to do us harm. They don't come into the sheriff's office to get a CHL.
Representative Widener yields.
Thank you, Representative. They don't have to worry about their personal information being subject to a public records request. They don't come and fill out the forms. They don't bother. This is about public safety. How is any of this information about a private citizen in the public interest? In fact, this information in the wrong hands can do harm, not just to the CHL holder, but to others in the community. Are we declaring open season for burglars looking to score or helping identity thieves punt their next mark. One of my constituents who testified said, given the economy, disclosing the names of CHL holders provides a list of targets for criminals. These are people who wanted to keep the fact that they own guns not a public issue. I'm sure many of you have gotten one or two emails regarding this bill. I did get one email asking me to put, I did not get one email asking me to put CHL license information in the public record statute. There were, however, a couple of emails that really, really got to me. Both were from women who did not want to be identified. The first was a victim of a horrible violent crime who was then stalked by her violator. The police could not protect her, so she got a CHL. The other was also attacked by a violent stranger. She testified against the man in court and got a CHL for safety. She said, having my private information made public actually re-violates me and takes away that safety. That information I put on those forms in order to obtain my CHL is detailed, extensive, and highly personal. Let's be clear about what could potentially be released here. Permission to use a visual aid.
Representative Thatcher requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules to use a visual aid. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Proceed.
Thank you. I have in my hand a stack of applications from the counties around our state. These are the applications one fills out to obtain a concealed handgun license. Now, according to legislative counsel, this concealed handgun license in your wallet is probably not the public record. Oh, no, not the case. The agency would most likely have to release the application for your CHL. Some are up to 6 pages long, and they're full of all kinds of information. Not only your home phone number, your address, and your email address, which I heard mentioned earlier, you could request the public agency not reveal, but there's additional information on here, like what kinds of guns you own, whether you were dishonorably discharged from the military, what controlled substances you are taking, if you have prescriptions for them, were you ever in diversion, and information in some counties about personal references, people outside of you. Oh, and despite the promises about how the sheriffs are all going to get on the same page and streamline things so that they all have the same application with the same information, you need to know that's already required by law. In fact, pages 8 and 9 of the bill, you'll see current law which says that the form shall be uniform. It's already there. And we're not just talking about actual CHL holders. This legislation also covers those who applied. So if you filled out an application, didn't pay, or didn't follow through for some reason, guess what? It's still potentially subject to being released. And one of the people who testified said this information is private information. The government has the duty to protect the individual. 10 states currently release handgun permit information through their public records process. 17 do not, and several more are considering legislation similar to the original House Bill 2727. The bill started out with 4 sentences, 9 lines long. Now it's 11 pages, and that should help tell you about something that happened along the way. Everything got tangled up in the whole notion that these records...
Representative Wingard yields.
Thank you. Everything got tangled up in the whole notion that these records needed to be placed in the public records law. And according to the legislative council, now that they're part of the statute, or going to be, a public body would not be prohibited from disclosing the records. Let me repeat that. A public body would not be prohibited from disclosing the records. Rather, the public record could claim the exemption or choose to release the records. This bill was amended so much it became, I think, unfortunately, an exercise in politics rather than good policy. And the sad part is we've already heard that the debate over this bill may have a chilling effect on those who were considering obtaining a CHL and packing legally. Now they don't want to run the risk of having their personal information exposed. So they may carry without a CHL. I think this should be concerning. Our constituents deserve a bill that actually does what they asked us to do and not create the illusion that we followed their wishes. I know most of us will end up supporting this bill, but in the end, I don't believe we've really protected the individual.
Further discussion, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, in my first session, which occurred, I think, before Oregon was admitted to the United States, I heard a colleague from Southern Oregon who once said, God, guns, and guts are what made this country great. Well, you may or may not agree, but I'll tell you one thing. Folks at Klamath Falls agree, and in Klamath County. Mr. Speaker, permission to use a visual aid.
Representative Girard requests that unanimous consent to suspend the rules to use a visual aid. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, in this box are over 3,500 applicants from Klamath County. These were secured in 10 days. If you want another 6,000 of these, it might take me a week, but I could get them. 3,000. That's just in 10 days. People in Klamath County want to be able to carry concealed weapons, and they want that kept private. To the good representative from Tigard, last Friday on your desk was a list of 1,400 reasons why people feel they should have concealed guns and have the records kept private. 1,400 good reasons why. The bill still leaves a lot up to the discretion of sheriffs or another government agency. You don't have to look back too far to some metropolitan areas of the state where sheriffs have had no problem in handing out this information. In fact, in 2006, the Oregonian obtained a list of all 12,000 CHL holder records in Multnomah County. Let me share with you briefly some of the concerns with House Bill 2727. It prevents the release of information identifying the holder or applicant for a concealed handgun license. That's not true. It doesn't prevent the release. It just sets up a few hoops the requester has to jump through to get to them. But anybody can get to them. And what is convincing, the vague terms of this bill, what is convincing to one sheriff sure as heck may not be very convincing to the next one. There's no definition in this bill, and legislative counsel says there is nothing defined in statute. LC said it is similar to highly probable, but not the same as beyond a reasonable doubt. Oh, here we go again with may and shall. Custodian. Who's a custodian? Is the custodian the person at the public lobby in charge of administering public records? Or is it maybe your librarian? Public body? Well, that could be just about any agency that has kept some form of CHL record on file, a Xerox copy of a license from a former foster care worker applying for a permit, a city police department that made up a list of
one time for whatever reasons, you name it. So the burden shifts to the CHL holder. House Bill 2727 now will require persons to know that they have the ability to contact the sheriff and tell him they don't want the information released. That's assuming, of course, the sheriff is the only agency getting a request for the information. In fact, how the heck is a CHL holder supposed to know which public bodies have the public records? So just sit there and start dialing about 100 of them to start with. The changes on the application form would apply to new CHL or renewal applicants. Man, there's no notice to the folks who got their license in the past 4 years. They're simply not even going to know till they go in and apply for a new one. And again, the license holder has to do all the work. The new law says the holder of the license may give the public body information on why they do or don't want their information released, if there's ever a request, and they may ask the sheriff to contact them if there is such a request for disclosure. But the sheriff, he don't have to do anything.
Representative Esquivel yields.
Thank you, Representative. He doesn't have to contact the CHL holder, and the sheriff only has to put some vague language on the application. In Washington County, they had two requests in the past year for the entire list of 10,000 CHL record holders. When are they going to have time contacting all those folks? They're not even required to contact them. And if they do decide to contact them, there's no time frame in the bill. How long do the sheriffs have to do the cross-checking? Week? Month? Year? They've also had requests in child custody and divorce cases, neighborhood disputes, civil suits. As far as this new law goes, they can just take the request on face value and say it was clear and convincing evidence and hand over the records. There is nothing in here to allow the agencies to redact information. All that personal information on the application forms go out as is. There's nothing required on the application form that'll help the sheriff make a decision about releasing information. For example, if some counties, there's a box to check off that says, do you want to have your info released or not? Check yes or no. But the bill doesn't even require that. The discretion of the sheriff or another public body, the reworded language in this bill leaves a lot up to the discretion of the sheriff. In fact, the sheriff now has to follow a vague standard. He's there to enforce the law, not to interpret it. So now we put every sheriff in the state of Oregon in a tough situation. And there's no provision for law enforcement here. The original bill said only courts and cops can get the records without a public records request. Staff measure summary on this bill is not correct. So if you're a parole officer, a city cop, civil court, or some other police agency, you don't have access to LEDS, then you would have to file a public records request or get a court order in order to verify someone has a valid CHL. Especially troubling for out-of-state police who pull somebody over with an Oregon CHL holder. They don't have time to wait for the public records request to be processed to get a subpoena. The provision allowing access for criminal justice purposes should have been left in this bill, and it was not. I will conclude, my friends. I want to thank the Judiciary Committee and its chair for trying very hard to produce a document that gives CHL holders the peace of mind they deserve. I'm not sure House Bill 2727 gets us there, and I speak for the, I think, majority of gun holders in Klamath County. They don't think it got there at all. Vote your conscience. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield? Representative Stigler, do you yield for a question from Representative Witt?
I do.
She does.
Where'd he go? There you are.
Thank you. A good representative from Bend. I apologize for not submitting questions to you earlier, but my questions have arisen through the course of previous questions that were asked of you.
I'll do my best.
Could you please tell the body what happens to an individual's ability to possess a firearm in the state of Oregon following conviction on a domestic violence charge?
To the best of my knowledge, they lose that right. Well, it depends on what the... Essentially, yes, they lose that right. We'll just leave it at that.
Additional question, Mr. Speaker?
Additional questions? Does the carrier yield?
Yes.
She does.
Could you also then tell us what would happen to an individual's concealed handgun license should that person be convicted of a domestic violence charge?
To the best of my knowledge, that also would be revoked.
Thank you very much. To the bill.
Representative Witt, to the bill.
Thank you. Colleagues, the public need not concern itself with the potential of criminal records, or criminals rather, possessing concealed handgun licenses. As a matter of fact, as a percentage of the population, concealed handgun license holders probably have the least percentage of criminal convictions of any group of Oregon citizens. It's simply impossible to possess that concealed handgun license if you've been convicted of a serious criminal violation.
Further discussion, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
You're being a very good sport today.
Ultimately.
I was going to make it an inquisition, but you've already been there.
I've experienced worse.
Okay. When I applied for my CHL, I was given the opportunity to check a box on whether or not I wanted my records held confidential, which I checked. Under this bill, presumably I'm on a do not divulge list. What happens to people like me? Will that continue to be kept confidential and grandfathered, or what happens?
Well, two things here. First of all, the fact that you are on such a list is probably, I would say, probably extra legal, i.e., the issuing agency probably didn't have the legal ability or authority to do exactly what it did. But that being said, under the current provision of House Bill 2727, there is nothing in the bill that would prohibit current holder of concealed handgun license from providing a public body with information relevant to a determination as to why your information should be kept confidential.
Representative Thompson?
Follow-up, please.
Further questions? The carrier
yield? Questions?
I do.
She does.
Is the sheriff required to contact each CHL holder to advise them that a request for their information has been obtained through a court order or subpoena?
No. What is required is that if the license holder or the applicant indicates that they would like to be notified and or give information as to why not those records should be released, they would be required to follow up with that licensee or that applicant.
Representative Thompson?
Additional question?
Additional questions? Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
In the event of a request for the entire county list, which obviously is tens of thousands in many cases, how much time does the sheriff have to contact each person and process the information through this statute?
The current law, which is unchanged under these provisions, indicates a reasonable period of time. Reasonable is the criteria used. So you take it from there.
Representative Thompson?
To the bill.
To the bill.
I understand what this bill is trying to do, and its aim is to be very protective of CHL holders, which I am one. I don't think we're there. My big concern for this bill is we have written so much into it that it's going to be a bureaucratic nightmare. The fiscal on this is listed as minimal. I can't believe for a minute this isn't going to dump a tremendous amount of work onto county sheriff's offices that are strapped for cash right now and simply don't have the capacity to deal with it. I think we can do a bit more fine-tuning on this. If it passes, I hope the Senate does that, but it's not quite ready for prime time yet. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, first I want to thank the representatives from rural Deschutes County and the Bend area for the hours and hours they worked on this, putting this together, getting it straightened out. It does provide the protection. There's people who opposed it came to me and said, well, clear and convincing doesn't mean anything. It does mean something. That's a legal term. That's just slightly below beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the burden of proof you need to convict somebody for murder, for example. The sheriffs came to us and asked for this bill because they believe that those records are open right now. They came and said, we have law-abiding citizens. We have great citizens. We have citizens who help us, who need their privacy protected. Please give us this bill. And the good representative talked about the sheriff in Washington County, who happens to be my sheriff in my county. When this first came up, that sheriff sent 10,000 letters out to every CHL holder and said, do you want me to try to keep this information private? And all but, I think, less than five people said they didn't care. The other thousand upon thousand said, please keep it confidential. Somebody wants to know if you have a CHL. The prurient curiosity of an individual should not outweigh the privacy of the law-abiding citizen. And my good friend, the representative from Tigard, kind of drug a red herring out talking about domestic violence. If somebody is convicted of domestic violence, they lose that CHL. But remember, somebody who's committing domestic violence is a criminal. It's not a law-abiding citizen. They're criminals. And they may carry a gun anyway without a license because they're criminals. They're not law-abiding citizens. And they could own as many guns as they want without a license and have them in their home. So finding out if somebody has a CHL in that case doesn't matter. Home invasion has nothing to do with a CHL. You're allowed to own guns in Oregon. You don't need a CHL. You don't need to register them. You can have guns in your home. So that's a red herring. And people in the newspaper might want to know if somebody has a CHL. If you qualify under Oregon law to have a permit, you're entitled to the permit. That's the law. So if a newspaper doesn't like a certain legislator, that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not that legislator qualifies for a CHL, and it's nobody's business. And if a sheriff is not doing his job, the other thing, how would we know if a sheriff is doing his job? If a sheriff is not doing his job, is doing something wrong, a citizen will call the press. What little press we still have left is the newspapers are folding around us. But somebody would notify them. Then the newspaper would make an inquiry, and they could go to a court and say, I have a clear and convincing evidence, once they'd done a little bit of searching, a background, and show the need to take a look at the sheriff's policies. And the reason we didn't write the law enforcement data system into it is it isn't needed. Right now, if an officer stops you and you have a CHL, up comes on the computer that you are a CHL holder. So the law enforcement can find that out without any effort at all. And I'll just leave you with one thought. Some of you who were here a couple sessions ago might remember my daughter, Heidi, who was counsel to the judiciary committees. 5'4", small gal. This past year, she sent two murderers to prison out of a gang murder in Portland. Does Heidi have a CHL? There's probably somebody might like to know that. Or is she just walking down the street, or does she have that 357 heavy frame that her father gave her? With federal ammunition, half jacket of hollow points, 1,800 foot a second velocity. Or is she a victim waiting to happen? People, it's her privacy. It's nobody's business. I ask you to vote aye on this. This is a good bill. There's been some misunderstanding from people who want to support it but feel it doesn't go far enough. It's a great bill, and if it needs any strengthening, I'm sure we can take it up with the Senate on the other side. But let's send this over there with a good do pass recommendation. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. Are you aware of any sheriff here in this state that would not give great weight towards consideration of release of records if they were aware that an individual holding a CHL had a history of domestic violence?
I'm not sure I understand. Thank you.
Not that the individual has been convicted of domestic violence, but has history of that. Are you aware of any sheriff that would not take that in consideration toward the clear and convincing?
If they were aware of that?
That's right.
I guess I'd have a hard time figuring that they wouldn't take that into consideration.
Representative Olson?
Follow up.
Further questions? The carrier yield?
I do.
She does?
There's been some sharing on the floor here today that talks about the length and how large this bill is. But the real nuts and bolts of it is Section 35 that creates two standards. Could you kind of just share with us again to clarify those two standards?
You bet. Essentially, if a court issues somebody a subpoena or issues a court order requiring the release of the records, and the court's going to have to operate under the same assumptions. They're going to have to be convinced that there's clear and convincing evidence otherwise to do so. And then secondly, the custodian of the record has been convinced by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest outweighs the interest of the applicant or the holder of the handgun license. So it's either a court making that determination, and probably ultimately it will be a court under most circumstances anyway, or the custodian, i.e. the sheriff, who makes that determination, and to a clear and convincing standard, which is a pretty strict standard. It far exceeds the other possibility, which is just that the public interest dictates it.
Okay, just one.
Representative Olson?
One further question then, Ms.
Additional
Speaker.
Questions? Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Just the last question then is my understanding that the Oregon Sheriff's Association is supportive of this, the Dash 8s, which is the A and Gross version.
As far as I know, that's accurate, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative
to the bill?
To the bill.
Mr. Speaker, colleagues, I'm in favor of this bill, House Bill 2727A, and I think it brings standards that we need in this state, and I'm 100% behind it. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Chris Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. In committee, some other folks have spoken around the domestic violence issue, but I wanted to clarify whether or not in committee there was any testimony as to how many crimes have been committed, violent crimes have been committed in the state of Oregon by CHL holders using the weapon that, in fact, they're licensed to carry.
I do not recall that there was any such testimony.
Okay. Thank you. To the
Representative
bill.
Representative Edwards, to the bill.
Colleagues, I had to ask that question because it's my experience in this building that there's no shortage of hypothetical, speculative, or claimed cases that might support an argument either for or against any bill. I mean, we all know we get lobbied on bills from this side and that side, on issue after issue, and as you know, it takes a bit of doing one's homework to get to what the truth is oftentimes, because there are a lot of people with vested interests in any given bill that are willing to put forth speculation and half-truths try to persuade one to support their position. Yet I have yet to hear any arguments or even speculation that that CHL holders are the problem. And frankly, I don't think that they are the problem. And because there is some concern about gun owner rights and from gun owner rights advocates that this doesn't go far enough, and so some may not like the bill, and I think you've heard some testimony from folks like the good representative from Tiger that don't like the bill for other reasons, I think it's necessary to clarify why I will be supporting this bill, because I think it gives the CHL holders more privacy protections than they currently have under the existing laws. Folks, protecting the private information of CHL holders is about protecting the rights of the good guys. And it is, you know, there's been speculation a little bit here on this House floor, and I just want to make it clear again that this is not about protecting the rights of punks and hooligans and meth tweakers. The guys that are breaking the law already, this isn't about them. This is about protecting the rights of law-abiding citizens, and I will be supporting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Sigler, do you wish to close briefly?
I plan to be brief, I promise. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, again, I do urge your aye vote on this, what I consider a very good compromise on this issue. And I want to point out a few things here, what this bill does. First of all, it does establish an exemption where none currently exists. I cannot emphasize this enough. Currently, concealed handgun license holders do not have any protection from the release of those records under current law. Secondly, it establishes legal standards under which disclosure can occur, and those legal standards are very restrictive, the most restrictive under our public records law. Third, it requires that a notice be placed in the application notifying the concealed handgun license applicant of the off chance that those records might be released, and gives them the option of notifying the sheriff that they do or do not wish to be notified in the event that somebody requests the release of those records. And finally, it actually mandates input from the concealed handgun license holder if they indicate to the sheriff that they wish to be notified in the event that a request is made for the release of those records. So I want to underscore one final thing in closing, and I think it's what the good representative from somewhere up north of me. The economic hub of Lane County, actually, yeah, we're not north, south of me, southwest. Get my directions wrong when I get over the mountain. Indicated that the sheriffs, when they appeared in front of us in committee, they made it very clear that they had a lot of confidence in concealed handgun license holders, that these were, by and large, the vast majority were good law-abiding citizens. What this bill attempts to do is provide them some protection, to give them some legal ability to protect their privacy and to have some security in knowing that, except in very stringent circumstances, their information is not going to be released. Again, I urge your aye vote.
Those of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Call, how do you vote? Call votes aye. Representative Barker, how do you vote? Barker votes aye. Representative Van Orman, how do you vote? Representative Van Orman? Van Orman votes aye. Representative Widener, how do you vote? Widener votes aye. House Bill 2727A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Because of the hour, colleagues, we're going to carry over other bills. We're in final reading, memorials and resolutions. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and the memorials and resolutions remaining on today's final reading of memorials and resolutions be carried over to their proper place on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009's third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills. Second reading of Senate bills. Third reading of Senate bills. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that the bills remaining on today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over to their proper place on Friday, May 8th, 2009's third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House, other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We won't do courtesies. I'll do an announcement. I have some friends from Lapine. Mary, of you and your court, this is Mary Fleshman. Mary is the sponsor and runs our teen court in Lapine, and she brought up all these judges from her teen court. If you don't know about teen court, it's a great program, and these are all judges that judge their peers. And thank them for coming up and extend the courtesies of the House today. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Great to have you here. Further announcements, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended in order to allow Representative Thatcher to change her vote on House Bill 2970. It will not change the outcome.
Representative Nolan requests unanimous consent to suspend the rules and allow Representative Thatcher to change her vote on House Bill 2970. It will not change the outcome. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Thatcher, how do you vote? Thatcher votes no. Representative Nolan?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Democrats, please meet me immediately in the caucus room. Grab your lunch, and we will go to a caucus meeting. Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Republicans, please grab your lunch and come to caucus.
Further announcements? Remonstrances. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I know the hour is late, but I would be remiss if I didn't remind this body that a great, to quote our friend from Happy Valley, a great American died this weekend. Congressman Jack Kemp died Saturday. He was 73 years old after a battle with cancer. As a lot of us know, he was a star quarterback for the Buffalo Bills. He spent 9 terms in Congress, of course was a presidential candidate, was a secretary of HUD, and then was a vice presidential candidate in 1996 with Bob Dole. Jack Kemp, if love it or hate it, was the author of Supply Side Economics, and so once again, love it or hate it, he was part of changing the world. He did believe that tax policy done right created growth, was responsible for creativity, investment, and entrepreneurship. Jack Kemp was also an advocate of the big tent theory, reaching out to minorities and to women, and regardless of the party you're in, I think we could all appreciate that aspect to life. He will be sorely missed. He was a great American, and I just want to acknowledge his wonderful life and his passing. Thank you, colleagues.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I just want to share some kind of sad news that I heard yesterday. If you recall, many of you do, Vince Capallo was my first legislative assistant back in 05 when many of us were rookies. He passed away Saturday back in Philadelphia. He was home with his mom taking care of him. Before Christmas, ended up stumbling onto some cancer in his throat, and eventually went to his brain. But anyways, he's gone, and just wanted to share that with you, because many of you did know him.
Further remonstrances. Adjournment. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move the House adjourn until 9:45 a.m. Tuesday, May 5th, 2009.
Representative Jensen moves that the House adjourn until 9:45 a.m. on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009. Without objection, the House is adjourned.